You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Best of Flashpoints for the week of February 15th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, Israeli lobbyists fail to register as agents for a foreign nation and have been getting away with it for years. Later, we'll feature a pair of interviews on Venezuela and the situation there. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's program with an interview from Monday's show on Israeli lobbyists who failed to register as agents for foreign nations and have been getting away with it for years.
Joining us to talk more about this and about the Israeli lobby is Grant F. Smith. Smith is director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. Grant Smith, welcome back to Flashpoints. It was just revealed, very interestingly, that when it comes to Israel and being foreign agents, the United States government doesn't seem to care, save the same way they might care if Paul Manafort was a foreign agent. You want to sort of talk about these special privileges in this context?
Sure. We have a law, and thanks for having me on, Dennis. We have a law called the 1938 Foreign Agents Registration Act, which is strictly enforced along political lines. If a country is considered an ally, the Foreign Agents Registration Act doesn't apply. If a country is considered an enemy, then of course it does apply. And so there's a recent attention to AIPAC and the Israel lobbying organizations about whether they should be registering as foreign agents, because the question keeps coming up. Are they really, as they say, basically trying to fortify the U.S.-Israel relation, or are they really working on behalf of the Israeli government and should be forced to register as Israeli government foreign agents? So I think it's a very timely question, because we have a new flap, as I'm sure you're going to discuss, with Ihan Omar of Minnesota making some casual responses to Glenn Greenwald about why Congress is so influenced by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And she simply said, well, it's because of the money. And many immediately misconstrued that as being a very horrible thing to say. But it's also triggered a huge debate online. And my contribution to that debate is this. In 1962, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee was part of an umbrella organization called the American Zionist Council, which the Kennedy Administration Justice Department said must register as an Israeli foreign agent. And instead of doing that, the organization fought behind the scenes not to register, and its lobbying division, AIPAC, incorporated 6 weeks after that order, and it's been with us ever since. So it's a great question you're asking, Dennis, and it's a great thing that Ihan Omar has given us a chance to talk about this past and what AIPAC is presently doing.
Would you just remind people exactly what happened in terms of the representative, the backlash, and how this is typical. This is modus operandi. You keep your mouth shut, whether you're a journalist, a commentator, a congressperson. You keep your mouth shut about Israel, or you are going to be marginalized, sidelined, you're going to come under attack. Talk about this. Remind us what happened here and how it's consistent in the big picture.
Sure. Well, again, Ihan Omar is a junior representative from Minnesota, and she had the temerity to yesterday wade into a discussion by simply tweeting a reply saying that quote, "It's all about the Benjamins, baby," to Glenn Greenwald, who was talking about how much time U.S. political leaders spend defending a foreign nation, even if it means attacking the free speech rights of Americans, as he said in his tweet. And so there have since been calls for her, Ilhan Omar, not only to be ejected from the Foreign Relations Committee, not only to be reprimanded by the Speaker of the House, but if you look at the most vicious tweets on this ongoing Twitter storm right now, to be deported. She's a Somali-American who came into Minnesota, and there's a thriving Somali community. And so this is where we get to. She makes a comment about some very big legislation that's in Congress right now to give missile defense, access to NASA technology, more aid to ban businesses from entering any sort of boycott of Israel's human rights issues and occupation issues. And she's wading into that, and she's essentially, there are essentially calls to deport her.
Wow, that is amazing, but not unusual. We saw, for instance, recently in Texas where I guess it was a social worker or somebody working with the school system expressed support for the boycott divestment movement, and she lost her job. We saw the CNN commentator say something truthful about the nature of Israel and Palestine. He was in trouble. This is amazing. Now, we see the Russiagate where Paul Manafort, among the things is the Trump administration, was Paul Manafort, were they secret foreign agents? They need to be prosecuted. I mean, who were the collaborators in collusion and undermining U.S. policy? Was it the Russians or the Israelis? I mean, talk more about this. This is amazing.
Well, many people are commenting about Dr. Mark Lamont Hill's ejection from CNN, and it wasn't for anything he said on CNN. It was simply because at a United Nations talk, he talked about the dispossession of the Palestinians, and that was considered grounds not only for ejecting him from CNN, but possibly from his teaching position at Temple. You mentioned that in Texas, there was a speech therapist, Bahia Amwawi, who wanted to continue her contract, but she was given a giant pledge saying that she had to forswear boycotting Israel as a condition of renewing her contract. And this is happening because over half of our states have already passed executive orders or legislation into law saying that contractors will be cut off from their state funding for a wide range of large and small government contracts if they criticize Israel, which is the only country which enjoys this sort of protection. So it's something that is huge. And of course, cynics will remark that, you know, one of the biggest flaps and misconceptions about Russiagate is the level of foreign influence, but most of the involvement with Russia was Jared Kushner and on behalf of Benjamin Netanyahu lobbying for the Russians not to allow the U.S. To abstain and allow a resolution condemning the Israeli occupation to pass. So there was, in fact, attempted collusion with Russia, but it was on Israel's behalf. So, you know, what we know about the initial actions of Trump administration operatives before they got into office is that in the areas that are relevant to foreign policy and important to foreign policy, the key issue was lobbying on behalf of the Israeli government against the Obama administration, clear foreign agency.
Wow, wow, wow. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Grant F. Smith. Smith is the director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. He is the author of the 2016 book, Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America. And he knows a great deal about how exactly that lobby does work. It's incredibly important to be talking about it. I'd like you to really take a few minutes. We've done this before, but I think it's incredibly important. Explain in some depth how the lobby works, how powerful they really are in terms of the U.S. Congress policy, weapons contract, however they have sort of infiltrated. Set that up for us. Let people understand more about what's going on here.
Sure. Well, in its present form, what you have to look at is the lobby as a multi-organizational ecosystem. But at the tip of that lobby is certainly the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It has a large office on 8th Street right next to Congress, and it has a dozen or so lobbyists who are basically constantly on the Hill visiting congressional staffers and members of Congress to promote things like withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal, upping U.S. military aid to Israel. Some of them lobby for increased intelligence support, which we don't actually know the figures for how much that is. They will lobby against measures such as a recent measure that expired about aiding child detainees who are mainly Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails. And so they spend their time visiting and going around on Capitol Hill, making clear that the constellation of organizations that they represent, which includes many large federations and many other organizations, are all accurately represented and that their legislative wishes should be adhered to. But the real power of AIPAC involves the many campaign contributions that it doesn't funnel through its own budget as a nonprofit, but rather gathering individuals who can make large, in many cases, maximum allowed by the Federal Election Commission contributions to candidates, often bundled together by AIPAC operatives and then hand it over to the congressperson with the clear understanding that this these funds are given to you on the basis of your advocacy and support for Israel. So the real power of the lobby isn't that it necessarily makes contributions, but it does signal which candidates should be supported. It will bundle and deliver campaign contributions, host candidate forums, or many of its adjunct and sort of astroturf organizations will do that. And so its real power is in steering campaign contributions to the senators and congresspersons who will most go out and advance their agenda. And so recently their agenda has been expanding USAID to Israel. They've lobbied to keep U.S. troops in Syria. S1, which is the first piece of Senate legislation, which has just passed, has all sorts of goodies in it. It's interesting, the very first piece of legislation to emerge after the shutdown, it's all about Israel. And so they have a privileged position on Capitol Hill, but they're also very secretive. There are a number of self-comments that they, you know, made by their own people to national journals saying, we're not always publicly identified as the force because we like to keep behind the scenes and you won't often see our fingerprints on things. So it's a little hard to research, but in general, they are really a large and influential factor. And you can see evidence of that because every March there's a huge confab in Washington, D.C. with 15,000 to 20,000 people gathered to the AIPAC policy conference, and just about every member of Congress turns out, and every single one will make these long speeches about their devotion to this program. So it's a quite impressive thing to witness, but it's just simply untenable to argue that power and money are something that isn't routinely acknowledgeable here, and everything that's been bandied about on Twitter talking about money and power is certainly legitimate speech and certainly an overdue conversation.
And when you want to talk about censorship or whatever you want to call it that allows the Israelis, for instance, say, since March of last year, able to go forward with this sort of slaughter against the Gaza protesters in which, I don't know, over 10,000 people are wounded, hundreds are killed, children, medics, with the most horrible modern weaponry, and you can't really get a substantial report on the networks. This is the lobby and related adventurers being very effective, right? How do you get away with that kind of slaughter?
Well, it's because most of these news outlets that would consider running a story about that great March of Return, they're not going to want to do it because they know they'll face an onslaught of defense organizations, as they self-designate, whether it's the ADL or local JCRC that wants to advance Israel by hitting them through the media, or FLAME, or other organizations that will come out, that are specifically funded to come out and pressure them for not to do that story. And so, you know, one way to measure all of that is there's a poll done through Google surveys, which is statistically significant, asking, have you ever heard or did you hear anything about the deaths of these Palestinian protesters? And 81.4% of Americans never received any news at all. So the real power of AIPAC and the rest of the lobby organs dedicated to press relations is that there's preemptive censorship. They just won't even run the story. And so when you ask a follow-up question about whether the U.S. should support any International Criminal Court investigation into that massacre, basically, most Americans will say no because they never heard about it. And that is power. And there's a great deal. Most of this is behind the scenes. Most of these are phone calls and emails saying, you should run this story. Here's a good angle. Shaping the news, punishing outlets that get too far out of line. And it's effective. It gets to the point where most news organizations just don't want to deal with these stories.
It is interesting. I listen to, National Public Radio. They never have, say, a Palestinian reporter reporting from Israel or Palestine, but it always seems to be a Jewish reporter that somebody like, I remember the former Jerusalem chief, Linda Gradstein. It was revealed that this reporter for NPR was doing lectures at Jewish community centers and sort of pro-Israel structures. Nothing was really ever said about that. She was getting a paycheck from NPR, and she's getting money from groups related to the Israeli lobbies. The reporting, they will say it, NPR, it doesn't matter. We don't care who the reporter is. We don't care if he's Jewish, he's Palestinian. But it's always a Jew reporting. You've got Wolf Blitzer, the former bureau chief or whatever of the Jerusalem Post, who wrote lovingly about Ariel Sharon. Who knows this history? But is he going to say anything about the lobby?
Well, I think the bigger issue is the person who's delivering this news compromised? Do they have a point of view, or have they had a long existence in which they're immersed in only one side of a multifaceted issue? You know, I don't think anyone would care. I think most people would be happy to hear, you know, I'd love to hear more Phyllis Weiss, maybe in the New York Times. He used to be at the Observer. But what happens is people are ejected and people are promoted, unfortunately, into positions where they can be, you know, effective voices, and the critics aren't promoted. So I guess, you know, one of the problems I see with the news media, and a big study just came out of Canada of all places, is the attention is imbalanced. And so I don't particularly mind reading stories whether it's an op-ed or a report, which is clearly focused on one side, but I would like to hear the other side, and I would like to have more voices from that other side have access to the op-ed pages of the New York Times or be reporters. I can only say that, fortunately, there seems to be a crack appearing at the New York Times, and they're receiving so much feedback in the forms of Twitter and comments on their own stories whenever they have kind of an old school, hardcore Zionist line of thinking in a story about these incredibly important topics. They get slammed for imbalance. They get slammed for having people who are reporters, but they also have sons or daughters in the IDF. Because the problem is for them these days, there's no way to hide the fact that your Jerusalem bureau chief is compromised. And being compromised means that you are completely immersed and have incredible ties to only one side of the story. In fact, maybe a life is on the line in your family. There's no way to hide that. And they're beginning to face massive pushback to do a better job on these stories.
Of course, I would love to hear, say, somebody from CNN interview Amir Haas, the great and courageous Jewish reporter who has been reporting from the West Bank for Haaretz for a long time. The unbelievable pressure she's under, the attacks, the kind of things that are said about her. She is a credible reporting for the Jewish community, for Haaretz. But let's see Wolf Blitzer interview her. That would be funny, huh? Will we, over my dead body, that will happen.
Well, exactly. She's a straight reporter. She's a straight news reporter. She's not a columnist. She's made an effort to be based in that part of the region, to tell stories from an occupied territory, and she's very, you know, straight line about it. But you're right. She doesn't have any real broadcast media access or platform, and so all of her incredible reporting has an incredibly limited audience, and Haaretz is really an island in the Israeli press anyway. Gideon Levy will say that it's a tiny, you know, it's a remnant, it's still surviving, but it doesn't really represent the media ecosystem over there right now, which is dominated by Sheldon Adelson's free newspaper and just incredibly harsh and unbalanced news reporting from other aspects of the media ecosystem there. So I think it is true. I really think that to the extent that people are going to report, they better have a completely transparent and accessible bio. And, you know, you look at those bios and you look at their reporting and you can make a judgment about whether or not their content is factually and unslanted enough to be of use. And, you know, every Brett Stevens that's given a special bullhorn to beat and berate and call, you know, pro-BDS supporters anti-Semites and call for this or that person to be fired, it's also valuable, as has been recently reported. It's good because they're putting BDS on the kitchen table as a discussion topic, and they're actually not even advancing their own cause because they're obviously in a panic mode. And people, I think, can see that there's a serious issue and a serious crisis that's developing here. So, you know, even the bad reporting and the compromised sources, in a way, are contributing to a moment of truth here that I think is unfolding this year.
All right. Well, thank you, Grant F. Smith. He is director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. He's the author of several books. He knows a lot about what the Israeli lobby has been up to. And I urge you to check out, what's the best website for you, if people want to follow your work?
Sure. People can go to irmep.org to see links to all of our research, or they can go to IsraelLobbyAndAmericanPolicy.org to see some of the latest voices who are speaking about these issues In particular, at our annual conference at the National Press Club on March 22. So those two sites are really good sites to see our research and other research about these issues.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us again on Flashpoints. We appreciate the good information.
Thanks so much.
To the best of Flashpoints for the week of February 15th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature a pair of interviews on Venezuela from Wednesday's program. First, an in-depth look at the U.S.'s latest attempt to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. Then, how the U.S. liberal war hawk media is a cheerleader for intervention into the internal politics of Venezuela.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we turn our attention back to Venezuela and how the news is dealing with Venezuela as opposed to what's really maybe going on the ground. And joining us to talk about that is Alan McLeod. He is author of Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting. He has written extensively on the situation for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and we're delighted to have him for the first time on Flashpoints. Welcome.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. If you are watching, say, the corporate channels, MSNBC or Fox, take your pick, there's sort of a democratic rebellion happening in Venezuela, and the United States wants to recognize the people's candidate, the new Democrats. How would you characterize the situation and the way in which the press is covering it?
Well, it's very interesting, you know, because we have in the United States this idea of a resistance media, one that's going to relentlessly fact-check Donald Trump on every turn. And yet when it comes to foreign policy, the so-called resistance media like the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, etc., have lined up shoulder to shoulder with the Trump administration in pursuing a regime change scenario. There's been an almost complete blackout of some basic facts that really undermine the narrative that there is actually a democratic rebellion going on inside of Venezuela. So, I mean, if you read the corporate media, you'll hear that there's a huge international coalition of the willing supporting, you know, removing this dictator. But in actuality, 75% of all countries have already come out to support Maduro, including the United Nations. Another thing you'll hear is that there is a terrible crisis going on in Venezuela, and that's certainly true in economic and social one. But one thing that's not talked about in the media is just how much the crisis is actually a direct consequence of the U.S. government actions. So, for instance, the United Nations has formally condemned the U.S. sanctions on the country, with the UN Human Rights Council urging every state to block the sanctions and break them, and even discussing the reparations that the United States should pay to Venezuela. In fact, one special rapporteur just came out and said that Trump's sanctions constitute a crime against humanity, and that has been reported in exactly one mainstream press outlet in the United States, Long Island Newsweek, but not in any of the big media outlets like CNN, New York Times, etc. So in fact, I think when you look at what Venezuelans believe themselves, this is another example of the right-wing opposition trying to force a democratically elected government out of power extra-legally.
And it's interesting to watch that it's really the sort of it's the Democrats, the so-called liberals and the liberal channels that are really promulgating this and forcing this, sort of forcing Trump to go right. Not that he needs a lot of push on this one, but one gets the feeling that the war hawks are the Democrats.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, the Democrats and democratic media don't generally speak in the language of humanitarianism and talk about how we have to get humanitarian aid into the country. You know, you might have seen that Maduro has apparently blocked some humanitarian aid reaching the country. However, there's a lot of inconvenient facts that are completely shunned by the media when talking about this because, I mean, for a start, the United Nations has again condemned this aid as not humanitarian at all and actually targeted at promoting certain right-wing interests in the country. The Red Cross has refused to go along with it. And furthermore, McClatchy has just reported that inside of this humanitarian aid, they found a whole load of guns and arms, which shouldn't be that surprising, seeing as Elliot Abrams, who was famous for, you know, smuggling arms to the right-wing Contras in Central America in the 80s under the guise of aid, has now been put in charge of sending aid to Venezuela. And so it is really remarkable that the Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, etc., have really gone after Venezuela in a very vicious attempt to try and force the regime out of power. There have been some Democrats like Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who've offered some resistance, but it's really the far left, like the Green Party, that is offering the most spirited anti-imperialist stance right now.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're speaking with Alan McLeod. He is the author of Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting, and he has written for the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting magazine, and also he is a member of the Glasgow University Media Group, and we're talking about Venezuela. Now, you would think if there was any journalist left in the corporate media, they might have some collective memory of the fact that, for instance, the United States has been engaged in undermining, overthrowing at one point Hugo Chavez, trying to kidnap him and saying that he was gone and it was time for a new government. But there seems to be no memory, no context, no reporting in terms of the evolution of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a long history of the U.S. trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government, and it's been trying for 20 years. It succeeded for a very short-lived period in 2002 where they kidnapped Hugo Chavez. But they've been trying all the time on a continuous attempt to try and force the government out of power. Leaked cables show that the United States has spent tens of millions of dollars funding this opposition party, and they have actually tried to force Maduro out of power once in 2014, once in 2017, and even attempted to assassinate him with C4 live on television in 2018. And yet the media really do have short memories. None of this context makes it into most of the mainstream accounts. And that's precisely why we get such a distorted picture of it, where people don't understand why the opposition is still extremely unpopular in the country, and Maduro still holds a decent amount of the population, perhaps a third of the population still supports him, which doesn't make any sense if he is such an obviously black and white dictator as the media portrays him.
Now, I want to come back to Elliot Abrams and the new Attorney General of the United States, because it is the new Attorney General who's, I guess he's about to be confirmed, he will be, Barr, was the one who wrote, along with Bush the First, the Iran-Contra pardons, and that included a man by the name of Elliot Abrams. He needed serious pardoning because he was, we used to refer to him as the Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Lying, but he was a front for the worst kind of dictatorships in the region, supported the worst kind of anti-communist purges we could imagine, referred to the nuns who were killed in El Salvador as maybe being involved in a lesbian tryst. We should be taking note that this guy is working in terms of a humanitarian situation. You want to talk a little bit more about the responsibility of the press to have this kind of information and make some context?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, context is king with all of this. As you said, Abrams was deeply involved in the creation and expansion of the death squads all across Central America in the 1980s. And his appointment, along with John Bolton in the Trump administration as special advisor to the president is a clear signal to Latin American countries about what's going to happen. In fact, there was a recent article in Bloomberg by a former admiral who said that with the election of Jair Bolsonaro, Latin America now has an almost clean sweep of U.S.-friendly states, and now we only have to collect Venezuela and Cuba, and that's it. You know, John Bolton said that Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua represented a troika of tyranny, which sounds altogether far too familiar to the axis of evil that we heard in the early 2000s in the build-up to the Iraq War. And yet all of this has been thrown down the memory hole when we look at media, who really talk about the situation in Venezuela with no historical lens whatsoever, no interest in understanding what the U.S. role is. In fact, I produced some research recently that was published in the Bulletin of Latin American Research, which showed that in accounts of Venezuela, the United States is overwhelmingly presented as a force for democracy, no matter what the situation, which leads to conclusion that actually democracy means whatever the U.S. government wants.
Whatever the U.S. government wants. What apparently here they want is an end to the Bolivarian revolution and to the self-determination of the people of Venezuela. We've seen this, of course, as you say, with Elliot Abrams, and this is a reinstallation, if you will, or a expansion even of the Monroe Doctrine, which, you know, back, I don't know how many, what is it, 100 or whatever years ago, said that everything south of the Mason-Dixon line or the U.S.-Mexico border or whatever is the United States' backyard, and the U.S. has the right to do whatever they want. And what they have been doing for so many years is wreaking havoc. It's amazing, though. It really is amazing to me that the current group of corporate journalists, they're really not even journalists anymore. They don't seem to understand what their responsibility is in terms of monitoring the centers of power and reporting back to the people. We've got a big problem. Are there examples coming up for you in terms of how the media is misreporting, the specific examples that we might be able to hone in if people want to sort of call this commentator or that one and say, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So journalism, as George Orwell said, was publishing things that the powerful don't want you to read, and everything else is just PR. Unfortunately, nowadays, journalists are not paid to think. They're not paid to give you this very interesting and important context. I mean, one thing we can talk about is when we're talking about Venezuela's food crisis right now, one thing that's not been reported anywhere in the U.S. media that I've seen is the very salient fact that the food production in Venezuela is controlled by huge international monopolistic corporations. For example, one, Empresas Polar, controls more than 50% of all the flour production and distribution, which is absolutely essential for the staple arepa cornbreads, which everyone eats there. Now, Empresas Polar's president is Leopoldo Lopez, the head of the main opposition party. The fact that he moonlights as the head of the distribution of food in Venezuela is never remarked upon in the media, and it seems to be an extremely salient point that it's actually the opposition that are in control of the food. And not only that, but they have formally admitted that they are conducting an, quote, economic war. They admitted that in the talks with the Pope in 2016, and they promised to stop hoarding food and produce it and give it out to the country, but they've clearly not done so. And yet this sort of basic fact is completely lacking in mainstream coverage.
What isn't lacking is how the corporate press has sort of taken the attack of the dangerous, tying the socialists, the democratic socialists, newly elected in the U.S. Congress, to Hugo Chavez and to the failure in Venezuela, and to sort of, it's a way of broad brushing the liberals in the corporate media, broad brushing the new progressive movement of elected officials who might see things a little bit differently. That's pretty amazing too, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Venezuela has become this one-word meme, which the right throws at the left to try and undermine and discredit any of their policies by saying that, you know, if you have a higher minimum wage or if you have free health care, you're going to turn into a military dictatorship where nobody has any food. It's completely bizarre because the American left, people like Bernie Sanders, have absolutely no contact with Venezuela whatsoever. In fact, Sanders has always been extremely critical of the Venezuelans. He called Hugo Chavez a dead communist dictator. But regardless, we don't let facts get in the way of a good political talking point.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there for now. But we appreciate the good information. We really think it's crucial to try and contextualize what's going on and give some history to the so-called current events being misreported. We're going to, of course, watch what the CIA is up to as well. We thank you again for joining us on Flashpoints. Hope we can continue this dialogue.
Yeah, sure. We'd love to.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. We continue our discussion of the situation in Venezuela, and we're joined by Steve Elner. He has written the piece, Regime Change Made in the USA. And, well, Steve Elner, this really does seem textbook. And now, with Elliot Abrams back in the picture, it's deja vu all over again. You have lived in Venezuela for some time. I'd like to begin there. Could you paint us a picture on the ground of the way in which the forces coming from outside have mingled with what appears to be the beginning of a coup, of the overthrow of the duly constituted Bolivarian Revolution? Could you talk about that?
Yes, there's a very close nexus between Washington and the opposition leaders now in Venezuela. You know, that connection always existed. Whenever there was a government that was considered hostile to U.S. interests, of course, we all know that Washington was intricately involved in efforts to undermine those governments. But it was never this blatant, in the sense that now you have an open coordination, explicit public coordination between the opposition leaders and the Trump government. For instance, protests that were called a week ago were called in order to coincide with the expiration of an ultimatum that the European countries placed on the Venezuelan government of Maduro. And so these protests were announced as protests practically in solidarity with the European governments, or what the European governments are proposing. So there's a very close connection, this close coordination between the opposition leaders and the United States and its allies, I think is really without precedent. It's never been this blatant before.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about what we know in terms of recent history of the United States meddling since the sort of the evolution of the revolution, if you will, in Venezuela. The United States has not been quiet for a long time. They've been trying to undermine, overthrow, disassemble the strong power and support for the Bolivarian Revolution. Talk about the way in which, over the years, the U.S. tried to infiltrate, destabilize, and perhaps this is a culmination of that policy.
Yes, it is. It is. It is a culmination, but it's been going on almost since the beginning of the Chavez government. Chavez was elected in 1998, and that coincided with the Clinton administration. Chavez had fairly, I'd say, cordial relations with the Clinton administration. But beginning with actually the bombing of Afghanistan, things changed under Bush. And, you know, a lot of people of the opposition say that the economic problems that Venezuela faces predates the sanctions. The sanctions, you know, Trump initiated those sanctions in his first year in 2017. And it is true that the economic problems go back several years under Maduro. But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. destabilization and actions against the Chavista government, like I say, go back to really almost the beginning of the Chavista government's back, at least in 2001. In 2007, just to give you one example, the United States ceased to sell spare parts for the F-16 fighter jets, which Venezuela had purchased from the United States back in the early 1980s. That forced the Chavez government to go to the Russians and to purchase Sukhoi jets, which were quite costly. He purchased, I think, 16 of those planes. So this kind of action has created problems, economic problems for Venezuela. And so it's not true that the sanctions and the economic aggression against Venezuela began with Trump.
Let's spend a little time on Elliot Abrams and the policy he might represent. We're already seeing questions about so-called food shipments turning into weapons shipments. There really is some diabolical planning going on, and Elliot Abrams is sort of at the cutting edge now.
Yes. There's been a constant escalation of tactics of the Trump administration, and this just takes things one step further. For instance, now the U.S. government has prohibited foreign oil companies from involvement in the Venezuelan oil industry. Total, which is a French company, announced that it would pull out because of the sanctions, because its bank account was getting frozen. You know, its operations in Venezuela were based on their offices in Houston. And it said that it just couldn't continue operations in Venezuela because of the sanctions and because of the freezing of their bank accounts. This is an example of how, in recent days, since the appointment of Abrams, that the situation has just gone from bad to worse. With regard to the so-called humanitarian aid, you know, the U.S. government, this is a publicity stunt. I mean, obviously, the treatment of the United States of the migrants from Central America demonstrate that the Trump administration doesn't really give a hoot about the economic problems facing people elsewhere in Latin America. But it's an attempt to create a situation in which, if Maduro were to accept, it would be humiliating for him. He'd lose a lot of support from his own people. If the Trump administration really was sincere about providing humanitarian aid for Venezuela, it would do it through the United Nations. It would donate that money to the United Nations and have the United Nations carry that out. So obviously, there has been an escalation of the tactics, and it has created problems for the Maduro government, both politically and economically.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Steve Elner. Steve Elner is Associate Managing Editor of Latin American Perspectives and is the editor of the Pink Tide Experiences, Breakthroughs, and Shortcomings in the 21st Century Latin America. And we obviously are talking about what's going on in Venezuela. You've lived in the country for quite a while. Give us a sense of what the impact has been on the ground. People are obviously suffering. There are real problems. Talk a little bit about how bad the situation is on the ground. Can we expect a lot more people to be leaving Venezuela? And how can we associate the different things that people are suffering to U.S. policy or foreign policy coming out of Europe?
Certainly, the situation is dire. There's no question about it. The situation is very difficult. Just to give you one example, the problem of hyperinflation means that people get paid and they have to spend their salary. People usually get paid on a fortnight basis. Every 2 weeks, they get paid. And they have to make purchases, that day and the next, because if they wait more than a couple of days, inflation will have eaten away the purchasing power of their salary. So that is a very, very difficult situation. Certainly, the U.S. sanctions have affected Venezuela in a lot of ways. Most people who have read about Venezuela know that the sanctions affect Venezuela directly in the sense that, for instance, Citgo, which is a Venezuelan-owned, 100% Venezuelan-owned oil company in the United States, has been prohibited from remitting its profits to Venezuela. Approximately $1 billion a year previously had been sent back to Venezuela. So the sanctions, and this was, you know, about 6 months ago, or actually I think it was about a year ago, the sanctions prohibited Citgo from sending those profits back. It made it very difficult, if not impossible, for Venezuela to refinance its public debt, something that all countries do when they're facing difficult economic situations. But there's another effect, which is more indirect, which people aren't aware of. It's not getting reported on in the media. And that is that the sanctions send out a signal to companies throughout the world, not just U.S. companies, but companies throughout the world, to lay off Venezuela, to not invest in Venezuela, or to withdraw from Venezuela. As a matter of fact, the sanctions go back to President Obama. In 2015, President Obama issued an executive order that declared Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security. And following that, there was an avalanche of U.S. companies that withdrew from Venezuela, Kimberly-Clark, Ford, then after that General Motors, Kellogg's, they all pulled out of Venezuela. So that this affected the Venezuelan economy also in a big way. So there's no question that the problems, the economic problems that Venezuela is facing that affect people in such, you know, concrete ways as, you know, hyperinflation, shortages of goods, reduced purchasing power, that those problems are very much related to the sanctions and U.S. Policy against the Maduro government.
Now we've got an extreme right-winger in Brazil. Again, we've got the United States applying all pressure, celebrating that new election. Can we suppose that we'll see now collusion, if you will, between the United States and Brazil and whatever other right-wing governments the United States can install to make sure it is the end of the Bolivarian Revolution? I mean, you're going to go back there and live there. I'm wondering what you're expecting.
Yeah, Dennis, I think it the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil does have a big impact because, you know, the so-called pink tide of Latin America, the progressive government, some more leftist than others, but they pretty much dominated the scene under Chavez. And that's changed over the last couple of years for a number of reasons. But so you have right-wing governments in countries like Chile with Piñera, Argentina with Macri, and Brazil with Temer before Bolsonaro was elected after the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. But those governments, as right-wing as they were opposed to military intervention. In fact, they criticized Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the OAS, who stated, who repeated what Trump said, that the military option should be on the table. And the right-wing governments of Latin America opposed that publicly. Now, things have changed with the election of Bolsonaro, who during the campaign hinted at the possibility of Brazilian military involvement in Venezuela. And Duque, who's, you know, a right-wing government the president of Colombia, I think those two heads of states represent a more radical position, which is more in line with the position of the Trump administration in terms of not ruling out military intervention. So that's a very definite possibility, and Bolsonaro really changes things in terms of the possibility that that will take place.
Let's conclude here with some scenarios. What's the worst case scenario here? What could happen? What kinds of things are you anticipating? What will be the signals that you see coming out of the U.S. or coming out of Brazil that tell you things are going from bad to terrible? What are you watching now?
Well, okay, the worst case scenario in my mind is that the opposition, you know, succeeds. in overthrowing Maduro, but keeping in mind that the opposition itself is divided and is very unpopular. The opposition is extremely unpopular. You know, the media talks about Maduro and his rating, which has gone down, you know, compared to Chavez, but the opposition is even worse in terms of what the polls state. And in addition to that, the opposition is now dominated by the more radical sector of the opposition, Vanguardia Popular, which is the party of Juan Guaido, is a more radical sector, which has opposed negotiations with the government, opposed participation in elections. The other parties that belong to the opposition, most of them have vacillated on those issues. But Vanguardia party of Guaido and Leopoldo Lopez is much more radical. And so if they were to assume the leadership, if they were to succeed in overthrowing Maduro, I think you'd have a really chaotic situation. Firstly, the Chavista leaders have a lot of support. They have a lot of backing. That's evident by their mobilization capacity, which we've seen over the last couple of weeks. Every time the opposition calls a protest, the Chavistas do the same thing and have big numbers to show for it. So that I think that the worst case scenario would be that the opposition, the radical fringe of the opposition, which the Trump administration has privileged, take over, and you'll have a really chaotic situation because I don't think people will, you know, readily accept that leadership. And in addition to that, the Chavistas will mobilize in opposition to it.
Will you be looking for traditional, if you will, ways of covert action that the United States is famous for? We have all these agencies that have democratic names, but they're all meant to overthrow foreign governments. I'm wondering if you see a role in those kinds of so-called humanitarian agencies that in the past have played the role of spoiler and participated in overthrows.
Well, certainly, and this is nothing new with regard to Venezuela. You know, Venezuela was the country that received the least amount of support from the National Endowment of Democracy before Chavez came to power to becoming the leading recipient in South America of that funding. And that has, I mean, that has been well documented. The relations between NGOs, which are covers for the U.S. government, and the opposition. So I don't think that that situation will change at all. You'll see a continuation of this covert kind of activity, and the U.S. government very well may carry out actions that are even less covert and more public, more apparent to everybody, but with the same effect.
All right. Well, we appreciate you taking out the time, Steve Elner. Among other things, he is the associate managing editor of Latin American Perspectives and is the editor of the Pink Tide Experiences, Breakthroughs and Shortcomings in 21st Century Latin America. We thank you, Mr. Elner, for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me on the program.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Goodbye.
Does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the second half of Chris Hedges' rousing speech on the corporate destruction of America and what to do. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last week, Chris Hedges spoke about the corporate takeover of America and about many of its bad effects. More of that this week, too, and some consideration of what to do. Some hints on that. For Hedges, Mr. Trump is a symptom and a result of the corporate destruction of all American institutions and values. Removing him will only get him replaced by a more skilled demagogue. Our best hope is to overthrow the corporatocracy. That's no easy task, and don't look for any help from the Democratic Party. Hedges spoke in New York City on December 9, 2018. His talk and his new book are titled America, the Farewell Tour. Here is part two.
These fines are used to fill state and county budget shortfalls resulting from corporations and the wealthy fixing the rules to avoid paying meaningful taxes, if they pay taxes at all. This virtual tax boycott by the rich has broken yet another vital social bond, the idea that everyone contributes a significant portion of his or her income to make the society function. The elites who sacrifice nothing for society and are not held accountable for their criminal behavior live in what Matt Taibbi calls a stateless archipelago, or what a writer for The New Yorker called Richistan. They are legally empowered to pillage the nation, amass obscene wealth, and wield unchecked political and legal control. Brett Kavanaugh, aside from most probably being a sexual predator, is, as Ralph Nader has said, a corporation masquerading as a human being. The result has been the obliteration of primary social bonds that, however biased in favor of the white majority, once held the nation together. The shattering of these bonds has left tens of millions of Americans adrift. Society, Durkheim wrote, is no longer sufficiently present for individuals. Those cast aside can participate in the society, as Durkheim noted, only through sadness. The self-destructive pathologies that plague the United States, opioid addiction, morbid obesity, gambling, suicide, sexual sadism, we are a pornified culture, hate groups, mass shootings, rise out of this enemy. And my new book, America, the Farewell Tour, is an examination of these pathologies and the enemy that fuels these self-destructive behaviors. Durkheim also noted that the poor have lower rates of suicide because, as he wrote, the poor know that the rules are rigged against them. James Baldwin made much the same point when he wrote that African-American men are less prone to a midlife crisis than white men because they are less susceptible to the myth of the American dream. Most African-Americans learn very early in life that there are two sets of rules, one for blacks and one for whites. But white Americans, because of white supremacy, are more susceptible to the myth and therefore more infuriated when the myth is exposed as a con. This, I suspect, is why nearly all mass shootings and members of right-wing hate groups, along with a majority of supporters of Donald Trump are white men. Capitalism, Durkheim wrote, is antithetical to creating and sustaining the relationships that are vital to social bonds. Capitalism rewards those for whom relationships are transactional and temporary. Relationships under capitalism are mercenary. They are part of the scheme for personal self-advancement and require the oily manipulation of others. To advance in a capitalist system, it is necessary to build and then discard a series of ultimately hollow relationships. These empty relationships, and you can see them on display at any business gathering, contribute to the collective enemy and disintegration of social bonds. Capitalism may cater to a natural desire among many for self-enrichment, but you don't want this greed to dominate society. Capitalism rewards single-minded narcissists and often con artists, devoid of empathy and incapable of remorse. It rewards those focused exclusively on personal gain and self-aggrandizement. Once a capitalist class achieves complete control, as it has in the United States, it dismantles the structures that make social bonds possible, seeing in them an impediment to profit. The more concentrated wealth becomes, as with corporate capitalism, the more damage it inflicts on society, sending jobs to overseas sweatshops and leaving American workers underemployed or unemployed. Trump is not the product of the leak of the Podesta emails, James Comey, or even racism, although he and many who support him are racists. Nor is he the product of Russian bots. Demagogues always arise from failed democracies, plagued by rulelessness, by anomy. They tell an enraged population what it wants to hear and crudely, to the delight of the betrayed, ridicule the elites who sold them out. Removing Trump from office without confronting the enemy that defines the lives of tens of millions of Americans would do nothing to restore democracy. In fact, it would probably consolidate the power of a Christianized fascism, rapidly filling Trump's ideological void, which cloaks itself in a cloying piety and false morality. Vice President Mike Pence, because he is a creature of the Christian right, would probably, as Noam Chomsky has pointed out, would probably be worse than Trump if he gained the presidency. This enemy, as it always does, has empowered demagogues who must be understood as cult leaders rather than traditional politicians. A disempowered population, infantilized by a world it cannot control, gravitates to cult leaders who appear omnipotent and promise a return to a mythical golden age. The cult leaders vow to crush the forces embodied in demonized groups and individuals which are blamed for their misery. The more outrageous the cult leaders become, the more they flout law and social conventions, the more they gain in popularity. Cult leaders are immune to the norms of established society. This is their appeal. Cult leaders demand a godlike power. Those who follow them grant them this power in the hope that the cult leaders will save them. Trump has transformed the decayed carcass of the Republican Party into a cult. All cults are personality cults. They are extensions of the cult leaders. The cult reflects the leader's prejudices, worldview, personal style, and ideas. Trump did not create the yearning for a cult leader. Huge segments of the population betrayed by the established elites were conditioned for a cult leader. They were desperately looking for someone to rescue them and solve their problems. They found their cult leader in the New York real estate developer and reality television show star. Only when we recognize Trump as a cult leader and many of those who support him as cult followers will we understand where we are headed and how we must resist. It was 40 years ago, last month, that a messianic preacher named Jim Jones convinced or forced more than 900 of his followers, including roughly 280 children, to die by ingesting a cyanide-laced drink. Trump's refusal to acknowledge and address the impending crisis of ecocide and the massive mismanagement of the economy by the kleptocrats, his bellicosity, his threats against Iran and China, his withdrawal from nuclear arms treaties, along with his demonization of all who oppose him, ensure our cultural and, if left unchecked, physical extinction. Cult leaders are driven at their core by the death instinct, the instinct to annihilate or destroy rather than nurture and create. And Trump shares many of the characteristics of Jones as well as other cult leaders, including the founders of the Heaven's Gate cult, Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who led the Unification Church, and David Koresh, who led the Branch Davidian cult in Waco, Texas. Cult leaders are narcissists. They demand obsequious fawning and total obedience. They prize loyalty above competence. They wield absolute control. They do not tolerate criticism. They are amoral and emotionally and physically abusive. They see those around them as objects to be manipulated for their own empowerment, enjoyment, and often sadistic entertainment. All those outside the cult are branded as forces of evil, prompting an epic battle whose natural expression is violence. A cult is a mirror of what is inside the cult leader, Margaret Singer wrote in Cults in Our Midst. He has no restraints on him. He can make his fantasies and desires come alive in the world he creates around him. He can lead people to do his bidding. He can make the surrounding world really his world. What most cult leaders achieve is akin to the fantasies of a child at play, creating a world with toys and utensils. In that play world, the child feels omnipotent and creates a realm of his or her own for a few minutes or a few hours. He moves the toy dolls about. They do his bidding. They speak his words back to him. He punishes them any way he wants. He is all powerful and makes his fantasy come alive. When I see the sand tables and the collections of toys some child therapists have in their offices, I think that a cult leader must look about and place people in his created world, much as a child creates on the sand table a world that reflects his or her desires and fantasies. The difference is that the cult leader has actual humans doing his bidding as he makes a world around him that springs from inside his own head. George Orwell understood that cult leaders manipulate followers primarily through language, not force. This linguistic manipulation is a gradual process. It is rooted in continual mental chaos and verbal confusion. Lies, conspiracy theories, outlandish ideas, and contradictory statements that defy reality and fact soon paralyze the opposition. The opposition, with every attempt to counter this absurdism with the rational, such as the decision by Barack Obama to make his birth certificate public, or by Senator Elizabeth Warren to release the results of her DNA test to prove she has Native American ancestry, only plays to the cult leader. The cult leader does not take his or her statements seriously and often denies ever making them, even when they are documented. Lies and truth do not matter. The language of the cult leader is designed exclusively to appeal to the emotional needs of those in the cult. Hitler kept his enemies in a state of constant confusion and diplomatic upheaval. Jost A.M. Merleau wrote in The Rape of the Mind, The Psychology of Thought Control, Menticide, and Brainwashing. They never knew what this unpredictable madman was going to do next. Hitler was never logical because he knew that that was what he was expected to be. Logic can be met with logic, while illogic cannot. It confuses those who think straight. The big lie and monotonously repeated nonsense have more emotional appeal in a Cold War than logic and reason. While the enemy is still searching for a reasonable counterargument to the first lie, the totalitarians can assault him with another. Cult leaders engage in the permanent lie. The permanent lie is different from the falsehood and half-truths uttered by politicians such as Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, or Barack Obama. The common political lie these politicians employed was not designed to cancel out reality. It was a form of manipulation. Clinton, when he signed into law the North American Free Trade Agreement, promised, and I'm quoting, NAFTA means jobs, American jobs, and good-paying American jobs. George W. Bush justified the invasion of Iraq because Saddam Hussein supposedly possessed weapons of mass destruction. But Clinton does not continue to pretend that NAFTA is beneficial to the working class, since reality has proved otherwise. Bush does not pretend that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Once it was clear, none were found. The permanent lie, however, is not circumscribed by reality. It is perpetuated even in the face of overwhelming evidence that discredits it. It is irrational. Those who speak in the language of truth and fact are attacked as liars, traitors, and purveyors of fake news. They are banished from the public sphere once totalitarian elites accrue sufficient power. The iron refusal by those who engage in the permanent lie to acknowledge reality, no matter how transparent reality becomes, creates collective psychosis. The result of a consistent and total substitution of lies for factual truth is not that the lie will now be accepted as truth and truth be defamed as a lie, but that the sense by which we take our bearings in the real world and the category of truth versus falsehood is among the mental means to this end is being destroyed, Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism. The permanent lie is the apotheosis of totalitarianism. It no longer matters what is true. It matters only what is correct. And federal courts are being stacked with Federalist Society judges who served the correct ideology of corporatism and the rigid social mores of the Christian right. They hold reality, including science and the rule of law, in contempt. They seek to banish those who live in a reality-based world defined by intellectual and moral autonomy. Consistency is discarded. Complexity, nuance, depth, and profundity are replaced with the simpleton's belief in threats and force. And this is why the Trump administration disdains diplomacy and has dynamited the State Department. Totalitarianism, wrote the novelist and social critic Thomas Mann, is at its core the desire for a simple folktale. Once this folktale replaces reality, morality and ethics are abolished. And as Voltaire reminded us, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. The cult leader grooms followers to speak in the language of hate and violence. The cult leader constantly paints a picture of an existential threat, often invented, such as the caravan, that puts cult followers in danger. The 4,000 immigrants, most from Honduras in southern Mexico, are in fact nothing new. Caravans of immigrants have been with us for several years. The beleaguered and impoverished asylum seekers, including many families with children, have made that journey from Honduras up through Mexico many times before. But Trump, aided by nearly nonstop coverage by Fox News and Christian broadcasting, used the caravan during the elections to terrify his followers. Just as he, along with the same media outlets, portrayed the protesters who flooded the U.S. Capitol to oppose the nomination of Kavanaugh, were portrayed as unruly mobs. Trump claims the Democrats want to open the border to these quote-unquote criminals and to, quote, unknown Middle Eastern terrorists. Christian broadcasting such as Pat Robertson's 700 Club was splicing pictures of marching jihadists in black uniforms cradling automatic weapons into video shots of the caravan of migrants. The fear-mongering and rhetoric of hate and violence, as I saw in the former Yugoslavia, eventually leads to acts of violence against those the cult leader defines as the enemy. The 13 explosive devices sent to Trump critics and leaders of the Democratic Party, including Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, George Soros, James Clapper, and CNN, allegedly by Cesar Sayoc, an ex-stripper and fanatic Trump supporter who was living out of his van, heralds more violence. And Trump, tossing gasoline on the flames, used that assault against most of the leadership of the Democratic Party to attack the press, or as he calls it, the enemy of the people. And it should come as no surprise that another enraged American white male, his fury and despair, seemingly stoked by the diatribes and conspiracy theories of the far right, entered a Pittsburgh synagogue and massacred 8 men and 3 women as he shouted anti-Semitic abuse. The proliferation of easily accessible, high-caliber weapons, coupled with the division of the country into the blessed and the damned by Trump and his fellow cultists, threatens to turn the landscape into one that resembles Mexico, where at least 145 people in politics, including 48 candidates and pre-candidates, along with party leaders and campaign workers, have been assassinated over the last 12 months. Look south if you want a vision of the future. The cult leader, unlike a traditional politician, makes no effort to reach out to his opponents. The cult leader seeks to widen the divisions. The cult leader brands those outside the cult as irredeemable. The cult leader seeks the omnipotence to crush those who do not kneel in adoration. The followers yearning to be protected and empowered by the cult leader seek to give the cult leader unlimited power. Democratic norms and impediment to the leader's omnipotence are ridiculed, attacked, and abolished. Those in the cult seek to be surrounded by the cult leader's magical aura. Reality is sacrificed for fantasy. Those who challenge the fantasies are not considered human. They are satanic. Behavior that ensures the destruction of a public figure's career does not affect a cult leader. It does not matter how many lies uttered by Trump are meticulously documented by the New York Times or the Washington Post. It does not matter that Trump's personal financial interests, as we see in his relationship with the Saudis, takes precedent over the rule of law, diplomatic protocols, and national security. It does not matter that he is credibly charged by numerous women with being a sexual predator, a common characteristic of cult leaders. It does not matter that he paid little or no income taxes and routinely committed financial fraud. It does not matter that he is inept, lazy, and ignorant. The establishment whose credibility has been destroyed because of its complicity in empowering the ruling oligarchy and the corporate state might as well be blowing soap bubbles at Trump. Their vitriol to his followers only justifies the hatred radiating from the cult. The removal of Trump from power would not remove the yearning of tens of millions of Americans, many conditioned by the Christian right, for a cult leader. Most of the leaders of the Christian right have built cult followings of their own. These Christian fascists embraced magical thinking, attacked their enemies as agents of Satan, and denounced reality-based science and journalism long before Trump. Cults are a product of social decay, of anomie, and our decay and despair are expanding, soon to explode in another financial crisis. The efforts by the Democratic Party and much of the press, including CNN and the New York Times, to discredit Trump as if our problems are embodied in him alone, are futile. The smug self-righteousness of this crusade against Trump only contributes to the national reality television show that has replaced journalism and politics. This crusade attempts to reduce a social, economic, and political crisis to the personality of Trump. It is accompanied by a refusal to confront and name the corporate forces responsible for our failed democracy and growing social inequality. This collusion with the forces of corporate domination neuters the press and Trump's mainstream Democratic critics. Our only hope is to organize the overthrow of the corporate state that vomited up Trump. Our democratic institutions, including the legislative bodies, the courts, and the media, are hostage to corporate power. They are no longer democratic. We must, like liberation movements of the past, engage in sustained mass civil disobedience and non-cooperation as we are seeing today on the streets of Paris. By turning our ire on the corporate state, we name the true sources of power and abuse. We expose the absurdity of blaming our demise on demonized groups such as undocumented workers, Muslims, African Americans, Latinos, liberals, feminists, gays, and others. We give people an alternative to a Democratic Party that refuses to confront the corporate forces of oppression and cannot be rehabilitated. We make possible the restoration of an open society. If we fail to embrace this militancy, which alone has the ability to destroy cult leaders, we will continue the march toward tyranny. Thank you.
Chris Hedges, concluding his rousing talk, America, the Farewell Tour, from December 2018. Many thanks to Wilton Vaught of Other Voices, Other Choices for re-engineering the audio. I have condensed part two just a little. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and please come back again next week. Peace.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake-Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
I'm joined on the show today by fellow 9/11 radio show host and researcher, Frank Tolupko. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
A recent show that Frank and I produced was criticized by a listener. I actually met with the listener to hear their concerns, and one of the things that they brought up was that we know that the official story of 9/11 is true because we have all the videos of the hijackers boarding the planes. But actually, in truth, there are no videos of that. And so this show today is speaking to that, about the hijackers, the videos, getting on the planes, some of them still alive, etc.
Why don't we first go to an audio clip, which was from a BBC TV broadcast a few days after the events of September 11, 2001, where at that point the FBI had already identified the putative 19 hijackers.
And here's that clip.
Last week, the FBI, having gathered evidence, confidently issued the 19 names of those who had seized the four planes. Many of them were from Saudi Arabia. Now it appears that some people with those names are still alive. The FBI is working on the possibility that the hijackers used stolen identities. All of this complicates linking the attacks to Osama bin Laden.
Take the case of these three men. Is this really Abdulaziz Al-Umari, the man in the airport picture? Not according to one Arabic newspaper who says it's spoken to a Mr. Al-Umari in Saudi Arabia. Then there's Walid Al-Shahri, another man named as a hijacker, but whose father says now lives in Morocco. And finally, there's also doubt about Khalid Al-Midar. Officials are thought to be looking at the possibility the name may have been an alias.
So within hours after the events of September 11th, the FBI came up with a list of supposed hijackers, which they quickly changed a few days later because some of the people, they could not be verified. The BBC went out and with the list that had been given and did some research in Europe and found out that a good number of those people that were identified were actually still alive. And in fact, they had showed up at American embassies saying, hey, why are you accusing me of being a hijacker? I'm alive. And oh, and by the way, my passport was stolen a few years ago. So obviously they had a juried up list that they put up initially that had no basis in fact. The BBC later, after much controversy over this issue, about 5 years later, the BBC came up, not with a retraction, but an attempt at explaining why they put out that list that the FBI had given them. It basically boiled down to the fog of war argument that's always used when the initial reports prove to be misguided or actually false. In fact, all they did was, they didn't apologize, they made a change to the story in print. Actually, the story was also in print, where they changed one of the identified putative hijackers to a man called Walid al-Shahri. And then they said that they were very confident that the story, as it was, remained true because they got in touch with the FBI and the FBI issued a statement saying that the FBI is confident that it has positively identified the 19 hijackers responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Also, the 9/11 investigation was thoroughly reviewed by the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States, that's commonly known as the 9/11 Commission, and the House and Senate Joint Inquiry. Neither of these reviews ever raised the issue of doubt about the identity of the 19 hijackers. Fact of the matter is though the 9/11 Commission report doesn't talk about it at all in their final report.
And now we're going to hear a clip from the film Loose Change, talking about the hijackers that are still alive and actually what countries they're in and where they are.
It's the funniest thing, but at least nine of them are still alive. Walid al-Shahri is a Saudi Airlines pilot in Casablanca, Morocco. Whale M. al-Shahri is alive and well. Abdulaziz al-Umari is a Saudi Airlines pilot living in Saudi Arabia. Mohand al-Shahri is alive in Saudi Arabia. Khalid al-Midar is a computer programmer in Mecca. Salam al-Hamzi works at a chemical plant in Yanbu, Saudi Arabia. Saeed al-Ghamdi is training to be a pilot in Tunis. Ahmed al-Nami is an administrative supervisor for Saudi Airlines. And last but not least, Mohammed Atta's father claimed to receive a phone call from his son on September 12th. 14 of the hijackers based their training in Florida and the five that allegedly hijacked Flight 77 lived in a motel right outside the gates of the NSA. Not to mention, the official autopsy report for Flight 77 does not list the hijackers, and the opening paragraph makes no mention of their absence. After these discrepancies were pointed out, FBI Director Robert Mueller brushed it off, saying that the hijackers were using stolen passports and may not have had tickets, so there's no way to know who they actually were. So, if there's no proof that the hijackers were members of Al-Qaeda, or if they were even on the plane in the first place, what justification do we have for bombing Afghanistan?
So even though at least 9 of the 19 hijackers are known to be still alive, have identified themselves in their countries where they're working, the U.S. government continues to use these original 19 names, and it's even in the museum in New York City, in the 9/11 museum, they still list these 19 men, even though 9 of them are known to be alive.
On September 21st, 2001, approximately 10 days after the events of September 11th, the Los Angeles Times published an article with the headline, FBI Chief Raises New Doubts Over Hijackers' Identities. And I'll quote from the article briefly. FBI Director Robert Mueller acknowledged that investigators may not know the true identities of some of the 19 suspected airline hijackers from last week's suicide attacks. Mueller said last week that he had a, quote, a fairly high level of confidence, close quote, that the FBI knew the real names of hijackers based on flight manifests and follow-up interviews. But while in Pennsylvania on Thursday, and that's going back to the original article, for a tour of the crash site there, he raised fresh doubts about the accuracy of the identifications. We have several hijackers, he said, whose identities were those of the names on the manifests, Mueller said. We have several others that are still in question. The investigation is ongoing, and I am not certain as to several of the others. Officials refuse to say how many hijackers may have used false identities, but officials of the Saudi Arabian government, our ally in the Middle East, said Thursday that 6 of the men that the United States has named as hijackers killed in the attacks appear to be living in the Middle East. Now, going back to what I said earlier, Mueller says that they had access to the manifest and look at the flight manifest, which are a legal requirement of every airline to name and track everybody to get boards of flight. Those have never been released to the public, the original manifest. What have been released and have been quoted as saying that their manifests are really the victim lists. And the victim list did not include any of the putative hijackers. They were asked about that, and they said, well, we didn't want to sully the names of the other people that died in the terrorist attacks. So why are they holding back the manifests?
Yeah, one really has to ask, why haven't we ever seen authenticated passenger lists? What might they be hiding?
Back in March of 2010, a Mr. Fujita, chief of Japan's Democratic Party, publicly stated that the 9/11 story as presented officially is a hoax and that many of the hijackers are alive. Here we will now listen to David Ray Griffin, esteemed theologian and 9/11 researcher, being asked about this particular issue.
The 9/11 hijackers are alive and well. That's according to the chief of Japan's Democratic Party, who says 9/11 is a hoax. Dr. David Ray Griffin is a professor and author who wrote the book The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. He joins us from Santa Barbara, California. So I'm guessing that you think that, and this is just an assumption on my part, that maybe this parliamentarian from Japan may have a point in determining whether 9/11 was really a hoax or not?
Oh, absolutely. The physical evidence is so strong for the destruction of the World Trade Center by explosives that we're really in the level of proof now, not conjecture. So on that score, I've just written a book on World Trade Center 7. It's called The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Official Story, the Final Official Account of 9/11 is Unscientific and False. And in that book, give a massive amount of evidence that's been compiled by scientists, architects, and engineers that all three buildings, although in that book I focus on World Trade Center 7, were brought down by explosives. There's simply no other possibility. And the only way that NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which wrote the official report, the only way they were able to deny that was to commit massive scientific fraud, which in simple words simply means they lied, and they lied.
Dr. Griffin, the politician who I'm talking about in Japan, his name is Yukihisa Fujita, and his claims are that 8 of the 19 hijackers are still alive and well, that this was all created by not necessarily terrorists, but people who are trying to benefit off the stock market. How much of this argument are you buying from Mr. Fujita? Or do you believe that it is kind of an inside job, but for other reasons?
Well, first of all, we have to be careful about this Washington Post editorial. Fujita himself says that they really distorted what he said. So we can't take that too seriously. But that said, certainly let's take the issue of the hijackers. Whether there were eight or so, we certainly know that some were still alive after 9/11. Walid al-Shiri, for example, showed up in Morocco and gave a press conference. The BBC reported on it, and they said there's no doubt about the fact that he is the man, because they had published, FBI had sent his picture around the world, and it was the same man. And then there's his brother. And yet when the 9/11 Commission wrote its account, they said that Walid and Wael al-Shiri were the ones probably on Flight 11 who stabbed the flight attendant. So they just ignored the fact that these two guys were still alive.
Dr. Griffin, real quickly, then the question becomes to you, why? Why would the government kind of cover this up, hide all this information?
Well, what we have here is an extreme example of something that governments, imperialistic governments, have done for a very long time. They're called false flag operations. You attack your own people. You blame another country or another group that you already had reasons to want to attack. Hitler did this when he was ready to attack Poland. That's how World War II got started. Japan did it when they were ready to attack Manchuria. That's how the Asian part of World War II got started. Our government did it in this case, planting evidence that these attacks were carried out by members of Al-Qaeda. But it's interesting that even our FBI says they do not list Osama bin Laden as wanted for 9/11. Now, our news media generally won't tell the people that, but it's the fact. And when one of our people asked the FBI, why don't you list Osama bin Laden as wanted for 9/11, the fellow who was the head of investigative publicity said, because we have no hard evidence that Osama bin Laden was responsible for 9/11.
Okay, Dr. David Ray Griffin, author, thank you so much for joining us.
And now we're going to take a look at the videos that don't exist of the alleged hijackers boarding the planes, along with the videos of the alleged hijackers at the airports in Portland, Maine and Washington, D.C., that do exist but have proven to be fabricated. So to begin with, I'm going to read a passage from the book called Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, Counterfeiting Evidence by Elias Davidson. And it's on page 50, and here goes. Apparently, none of the three airports from where the 9/11 aircraft reportedly departed, Boston's Logan, Newark International, and Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C., had surveillance cameras above the boarding gates. There exists neither eyewitness testimony nor a visual documentation of the boarding process. The Boston Herald reported a few weeks after 9/11, quote, in perhaps the most stunning example of Massport's lack security safeguards, Logan International Airport is missing a basic tool found not only in virtually every other airport, but in most 7-Elevens. While Massport does employ cameras in the parking garages, ramp areas, and on Logan's roadways to monitor traffic, there are none to be found in the terminals, gate areas, or concourses. You have names of hijackers, but the FBI has said it hasn't been able to match the faces of those who were on the flights, said Charles Slepian, a New York security consultant. Logan officials acknowledged this deficiency. This is significant because two of the 9/11 flights originated from Logan Airport. According to the 9/11 Commission staff, Newark International Airport, from which Flight United 93 reportedly departed, did not have such equipment. According to the 9/11 Commission's final report, there is no documentary evidence to indicate when the hijackers passed through the security checkpoints, what alarms may have been triggered, or what security procedures were administered. Yet public opinion remains convinced that surveillance videos of the suspected hijackers have been shown on television. Indeed, something was shown around the world on television, but not the boarding process of any of the four aircraft. What was shown were two short video clips of people passing a security checkpoint, one reportedly from the Portland, Maine Jetport, and the other from Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. The video from Portland Jetport purports to show suspected hijackers Ada and Alomari passing the security checkpoint before they board a flight to Boston on the morning of September 11, 2001. Its authenticity has been disputed for two reasons. One, Michael Toohey, who checked in Ada and Alomari at the Portland Jetport, said on CNN that during check-in that they had on ties and jackets. Shown the security video, he discovered that they have like dress shirts with open collar. No one could explain what happened to their jackets. Number two, the security video displays two different recording times. And now we're going to hear from Jay Kolar speaking at the Toronto hearings in 2011, which Frank and I both attended. And here he is discussing the videos.
It's now my pleasure to introduce the first of today's expert witnesses, Jay Kolar. Jay Kolar is a freelance writer in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. As a film studies instructor, he has taught courses in film analysis and mass media at Lane Community College, the University of Iowa, and the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA. A specialization in French film theory, semiotics, and close structuralist analysis of film stimulated his critical response to the events of September 11, 2001, leading him to examine more closely the available 9/11 footage and subsequent releases of Bin Laden and alleged hijacker Last Will and Testament martyrdom videos. Jay Kolar is the author of an essay, What We Now Know About the Alleged 9/11 Hijackers, in The Hidden History of 9/11, a book edited by Paul Zaremka and first published by Elsevier Press in 2006. He supplemented this essay with an update in the expanded edition published in 2008 by Seven Stories Press in New York. Jay Kolar will present his evidence on the subject of the alleged 9/11 hijackers. Jay Kolar.
Well, I want to change that title to the 9/11 hijackers that weren't. I say that because the U.S. government's story, upon close examination of the evidence, of which I'm only going to be able to present a small segment today, reveals an accumulation of flaws, distortions, omissions, video forgeries, alterations of the alleged hijackers' timelines, fabricated evidence, planted evidence, substitutions of names and doubles for the alleged, intimidation of eyewitnesses and whistleblowers, and up to now, media blacking out of protected activities of some of the alleged who had deep political connections. Under the weight of all these flaws, the official story collapses. We begin with the FBI's initial list of hijackers, which should have been released concurrently with a flight manifest that were never released after the FBI had quickly confiscated them. The FBI said it had located its suspects from those manifests, not to be mistaken for the passenger lists made available by the airlines, which contained none of the 19 names. But within 24 hours, CNN had acquired this first FBI list from U.S. Customs, and one of the relevant customs officials is Robert Bonner. But it contained five names: a Moziar Khanid on Flight 77, and four others, Adnan Bukhari, Amir Bukhari, Amir Kamfar, and Abdul Rahman Alomari. From the Flight 11 manifest, names that the FBI dropped and replaced with Walid Anwa'il al-Sheri, Satam el-Sukami, and Abdul Aziz Alomari. Logically, that would mean that there should have been, including the name of Mohammed Atta on that first Flight 11, who had not been replaced by a substitute, at least nine Arab names from which to choose. But there weren't. Since none of the airline lists, which only contain passengers minus hijacker names, contain any of those Arab names, which were changes the FBI had implemented, therefore tampering with crime scene evidence. It is important to note that reputable documented sources verified that at least nine of the FBI's second and final list of 19, the ones depicted here, were still alive after 9/11, with proof that at least one other, Ziad Jarrah, or Jarrah, had his identity doubled. The double's photo on a U.S. visa, one-third singed by the crash, showing someone who resembled more a young Tom Jones, the singer, and the real Jarrah's identity therefore fabricated and Jarrah himself framed. Nevertheless, the FBI has refused to make the necessary corrections to exonerate those 10 out of the 19 falsely accused. First, I'm starting with the U.S. government's best evidence, which we will see is actually the worst evidence of hijackers, the Dulles Airport video. Compare that, the Dulles video still, to a Portland Jetport video still on the left. The only other video we have of the alleged aborting planes on 9/11 was the one from the Portland Jetport, where in the frame on the left, Atta and Aziz Alomari proceeded to board a connecting flight, not the Flight 11 that crashed. While this disqualifies it as evidence of a flight that crashed, it does show the verifiable airport security data, which continues throughout the video's duration, the date, digital ongoing time of day, and the closed-circuit TV identification number, which reveals the camera's location, all necessary to authenticate an event as well as the video itself. The absence of such data on the still from the Dulles Airport video, on the other hand, is the first of six major problems we have with it. Unlike the Portland video and unlike every other airport surveillance video we've seen, it lacks verifiable authenticity, which can only come from imprinted security data, the date, the digital ongoing clock, and camera number. Researcher Joe Viales in 2004, through his connections, was able to obtain a Dulles Airport package, including outdoor photos of 9/11 Dulles Terminal. Viales meticulously examined every inch of the Dulles video, blown up over 20 times, but he could find no trace of edited out security data. Thus, lacking imprinted security data on the entire tape, standard for all airport videos, and without evidence to indicate erasure, there is no possibility that the Dulles video is authentic, hence the probability that it is a forgery. Devoid of such security data, both as a security video and as evidence of an event to be used in a court of law, what possible use could this video have? Located at an airport security checkpoint, a security camera that records without imprinting security data is completely suspect. Second, the presence of Salam al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar allegedly preparing to board Flight 77 introduces the second problem. Both he and al-Midhar turned up still alive after 9/11. In al-Midhar's case, one report comes from the FBI itself, which warned all banks to watch for him after 9/11. Quote, on September 19, 2001, the FDIC distributed an official document clearly stating that al-Midhar is alive. As for Salem, he testified for himself that on 9/11 he was working at a Saudi petrochemical complex in Yanbu, Saudi Arabia. A third problem stems from the exterior lighting and shadows covered by Paul Zaremka, following on Vial's research on the exterior views in the Dulles video package he received. A Dulles Airport terminal exterior view shows the time would be around midday and not 7:18 a.m. when the hijackers allegedly entered the security checkpoint. The exterior lighting is too bright and the shadows are wrong for an early Washington, D.C. September morning. Okay, this photograph is simply a representative view, a sample, because the other is unavailable at this time from Jovial's closed-down website. But this sample exterior Dulles view suffices to show the immediate proximity of roadway just outside with a windowed entrance to the terminal. In this perspective, the security camera inside the security checkpoint is pointing screen left, which is north, and directly at the mostly windowed wall and entrance in the background. What I wanted you to notice here is that when we roll the video, you'll see one could expect to see some traffic in that background. We obviously don't. And that is in the 2006 video release, or after, that was found in the Misawi trial documents. Absence of any background traffic movement therefore also undermines the video's authenticity. It took 3 years for the original release of the Dulles Airport video in 2004. In a heavily edited, and they only showed heavily edited versions of between 57 seconds and 150, well, 2.5 minutes in duration, out of a possible 22 minutes from first to last alleged hijacker, which is a maximum of only 10% of total duration. Those initial versions have poorer, grainier resolution than most security videos, due partially to the bright sunshine streaming in, and about twice the brightness expected when facing this northern perspective at 7:18 a.m. Bright backlight tends to wash out the resolution, also indicating the taping time around noon or so. That is, unless the camera inside the building is not facing north, in which case this could not be Dulles. Either way, the authenticity of this video is undermined. To make viewing even more difficult, in the current version we have now from the Musawi trial documents, faces, this is an example, in the 2006 version are smudged out, not digitally, but they are disguised to prevent recognition. It looks like somebody took some sort of eraser on the film and just emulsified over the faces. Why would the U.S. government prevent its citizens from recognizing both the alleged and other passengers and officials? And why, in the 2004 original version, did they release only 57 seconds to 150 seconds max? In this minuscule Dulles Airport video versions, in which 90% of total duration has been deleted, an obvious smudging of faces, noticeable as passengers come into focus in the foreground and obfuscate the remaining 10%. When all versions of the Dulles video have been made available in such a parsimonious way, and then only after family members had successfully sued for its release, the resultant effect is one of cover-up, not presentation of evidence. Here, the fifth problem of the camera movement and visual manipulation, both of which I described in my chapter, which came out in 2006, at which time only the 2004 version, which was heavily edited, of the Dulles video was available. This heavy editing included cuts or splices, multiple sized views or shots of various sizes, medium shots, close-ups, and two inexplicable establishing long shots, but only one you'd expect from a closed-circuit TV camera. And also camera movement. Especially this camera movement appears in a shot which lasts 38 seconds in the Court TV 150 second version from 2004, which is follow on action, zoomed in. By the way, I can't find that version anymore because that site has changed and it's no longer available. If you look at the floor stripe, it's moved. So you can see both, if you shoot the closed circuit TV camera in a ceiling, is in one place at one time, and then 6 to 8 feet to the right in another time. You didn't notice it. Nobody noticed it when they saw it because of this 38-second slow-motion, zoomed-in close-up of the alleged El Midhar walking left to right in more of a medium close-up in the foreground, which intervenes between those two shots. The one shot presented the first two hijackers who arrived, and the last shot showed the other two, which it's impossible in a purely mechanical operation of a closed-circuit TV camera. It betrays human intervention, selection, and exclusion of other passengers not possible in the alleged closed-circuit camera the commission tells us we are getting our viewing experience from. It's no longer available from the Court TV site, but as I said, the photograms that we have are still happily available. And they reveal, besides the aforementioned evidence, the distinctly two camera setups. Are we then to conclude that there are two airport surveillance cameras embedded in the ceiling? So you can see the camera stripe moves. But we don't have any of this in the current 2000 released version, where they decided to leave all the editing out and just show you one view that was shot from above the center floor line, or centered over the floor line. Simultaneously with this new second setup after the intervening 38 seconds of El Midhar, another problem has occurred. The 150-second Court TV version, which temporarily the longest of the 2004 version, has somehow neglected to include anyone showing up as the pilot Hajour, in quotes, between the arrival of the two duos. In the shortest version, ironically, the 57-second one, there is a very brief glimpse of a man, but he's not Hajour. The overall difficulty in viewing these versions made available to the public is that they contain only a mere fraction of the approximately 22 minutes of this Dulles footage that's going by the commission's, noting that the time of arrival of the first alleged hijackers, the pair, and the arrival of the last pair. The darkly dressed, fully bearded, heavier set mystery man in the 2004 Dulles video, small version, appears starring in the role of Hajour. So suddenly he appears in the Moussaoui trial documents. But that's still not him, okay? Would not have merited much attention for one very important reason. He was not Hajour at all. Hence, challenging the integrity of the Dulles video is the fact that the FBI and the commission, having access to this ATM photo of Hajour, would surely have noticed that the man dressed in dark slacks and dark short-sleeved shirt does not remotely resemble Hajour, yet they apparently tried to pass him off. From all the accounts we have of Hani Hajour, he was slightly built, okay, thin, gaunt, just over 5 feet tall. The U.S. government had as its best evidence the Dulles video purportedly showing them preparing to board a plane that they said crashed into the Pentagon. All six of these problems, however, combined to undermine the Dulles video's authenticity and corroborate its forgery. It's the flimsiest evidence upon which the entire weight of the official story collapses. No airport security video has appeared for the other flights. Therefore, no evidence exists that any of the so-called hijackers ever boarded planes that crashed on 9/11.
So we spent the last half hour listening to various people talking about the veracity of the 9/11 official story, especially in reference to the so-called hijackers. So the only thing I would add to that is to piggyback on the phrase, show me the money, show me the manifests, show me the boarding passes, show me the unedited video, show me all the other stuff, and then maybe I'll believe it.
Frank, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. U.S. hands off Venezuela. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro called Brazilian President Bolsonaro a modern-day Hitler. Days after Brasilia officially recognized Juan Guaido, the head of Venezuela's opposition-run Congress, as legitimate president of Venezuela. Bolsonaro, a fervent anti-communist who has praised his country's 1964 to 85 military dictatorship, has promised to target Venezuela. To discuss democracy at risk in Latin America and the far right moving in is Maria Luisa Mendonca, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, Kevin Zeese, a lawyer and political activist who currently serves as co-director of Popular Resistance, and Roger Wareham, secretary general of the International Association Against Torture and member of the December 12th Movement.
Please. Thank you.
Maria Luisa Mendonca, let's begin by talking about the death toll from a Brazilian dam collapse at an iron mine, which has risen to over 100, with hundreds still missing. Indeed, the mining town of Brumadinho, which was nearly buried by the deluge.
We have now an openly fascist government of Bolsonaro. One of the first things he did was to say that he was not going to do any more environmental regulations in Brazil, and that he wanted to actually abolish the Ministry of Environment. What we see now is the consequences of not having strong environmental regulations. It's a huge tragedy in Brazil. Hundreds of people are missing and dozens were killed by this mining company, Vale, that was privatized in the 90s. And it's a private company that is very little regulation. This is the second huge disaster in 2015. Another dam also caused a huge disaster. It killed a whole river, and a very large region was destroyed, and 19 people were killed. We are in the situation in Brazil where we have seen a very strong repression now against social movements in the countryside, against indigenous people. We have threats also of repression in urban areas. One point about turning to attacks on Venezuela, the attacks on Venezuela by Bolsonaro and also by Trump, is also a way to have people distracted from the problems we have. Trump is facing a lot of trouble here in the U.S. and in Brazil. Bolsonaro is facing accusations, especially his son is facing accusations of connections with the militia groups accused of killing state representative Marielle Franco last year, who was assassinated. So We have accusations of corruption. We have many bad news coming out of Brazil, and turning the attacks on Venezuela is a way to get people distracted from the real problems that right-wing governments are facing.
What do you think the relationship of Trump and Bolsonaro means to what had been a movement in the last 10 years towards a leftward trend and a democratization of Latin America? And now, where do you see this going, and how important is it really to Latin America that you have somebody like Bolsonaro in power and have a firm tie and relationship to the Trump administration?
For over a decade, we had governments in Latin America that created a much more independent foreign policy in relation to the U.S. Now, with Trump and with several countries in Latin America being controlled by right-wing forces, you know, Brazil, Argentina, Colombia, Paraguay, Honduras. Also, we need to remember that we had a series of parliamentary coups, and first the coup in Honduras, then a parliamentary coup in Paraguay. Then we had a parliamentary coup against President Dilma in 2016 in Brazil. And that's how we got Bolsonaro, because, you know, Brazil cannot be considered a democracy anymore. We had the parliamentary coup against President Dilma, and then in order to prevent former President Lula from running, right-wing forces in the country also articulated an accusation against him, and he is in jail, although there is no clear evidence against him, but he is in jail anyway. You know, the United Nations, several people have protested against this because it's clearly persecution, a political persecution against him. Because if he was able to run, he's still the most popular politician in the country, but he could not run for president. So what happened was there was this political vacuum created because of this situation, and that's how you got Bolsonaro. Also, there was a huge campaign, a fake news campaign, and the Bolsonaro campaign, that they had ties with people like Steve Bannon, and you know, there was a lot of media manipulation in Brazil for years and years. You had the mainstream media attacking the Workers' Party and the left, and then you had the huge campaign of fake news on social media. So all of that created this context for Bolsonaro to win. And, of course, the U.S. and the Trump administration have an interest in that because they want to have a hard line against progressive forces in Latin America.
The Trump administration has found a new bedfellow, Brazil's new president, Bolsonaro, and the emerging bromance between the right-wing presidents of the Americas. So we have some of the largest countries in line with the friendly relationship that Trump has developed. So you have Duque in Colombia and Mauricio Macri of Argentina. I want to bring Kevin into the discussion and Roger Wareham. And I'm interested in how critical you think, or what you think about this movement in relationship to our duties and our responsibilities as anti-imperialists, anti-colonialists, to deal with what many people have been caught off guard here or don't understand, how fundamentally still we see our involvement in Latin America, and now first and foremost with the attack on Venezuela. Kevin?
The United States has had its eye on Latin America for quite some time. They took their attention off it in the early 2000s with the Iraq War and George W. Bush. But Obama has been working to end the leftward flow in Latin America, and now Trump is continuing it. And Venezuela is the key to protecting this move toward more people-oriented governments, and so that's why it's one of the targets. And while this has been happening, the U.S. has been really in an ongoing coup since the Chavez election. Regime change has been on the agenda. Economic warfare has been on the agenda. Working with the oligarchs to disrupt the economy from within has been on the agenda. Now we're seeing it with this very open coup. And I think no one denies now. Everyone recognizes this is a U.S. coup. Siguero featured on the New York Times op-ed page looking like a choir boy to fool the public, fool the United States into what's going on there. But this is a U.S. coup with the oligarchs. And the first acts of Guaido were to seek to privatize the oil industry, which would deny the people of Venezuela that money that's being used to lift up the poor. And second was to look for loans from the IMF, which would put Venezuela under the thumb of Western bankers. So this is what this is about. And, you know, the U.S. is allied with democracy-less government in Brazil, with Colombia, and this rightward tide is something the U.S. has been pushing to regain control of Latin America.
Roger Wareham.
I would agree with what's been said by both of the speakers. When we look at what's happening in Latin America now, we should understand that the U.S. interest is in the particular of Venezuela, oil and ideology. The oil is self-evident. Kevin just pointed out that. And Pence or Pompeo, one of them said the other day that they're, you know, that the United States can run the United States companies can run the oil more efficiently and produce it more efficiently than the Venezuelans can. So it's clear that one of the things in terms of we understand in the beginning of the 21st century as capitalism is going through its throes of an economy that it really cannot recover from. And it's going to try and monopolize all of the resources that it can. So you have the question of oil and coltan and different resources in Latin America. You also find the same thing in Africa in terms of, in particular, Zimbabwe as a push to effect regime change in a country which has taken a position that is opposed to that of the United States and Western countries, one in terms of return of its land to the indigenous people, and also sitting on a number of important minerals so that it's not restricted to Latin America, but the focus is on that right now. So you have that, and then you have the question of ideology in terms of when the Trump administration talks about the troika of tyranny or whatever they call it, and they're talking about Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, they're focusing on the countries which are socialists or which aspire to socialism. So they have a double-edged reason in terms of the intervention. And then, of course, in the particular of Trump, it's also a distraction from the legal problems that are imminent that he's facing in the United States. So we have to look at all of that in terms of our analysis. I think it's important that we mobilize all the people that we can, and the mobilization has to require the type of political education that is going on right now in terms of this show, that we have to get people to understand why it's important for them to be involved in the struggle to stop U.S. intervention in Venezuela, why it affects them, the people. You know, Amilcar Cabral, the leader of the liberation movement in Guinea-Bissau, wanted people not fight for abstract ideas, they fight for food, clothing, and shelter. So it's our responsibility to be able to translate our understanding of the ideas to their interests and to be able to mobilize them.
What we have seen is that Brazil, the coup against President Dilma had to do with oil because Brazil has large offshore oil reserves. President Dilma guaranteed that Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, would have priority in all the contracts for those reserves, which also means that the pace in which those reserves would be exploited would be slower. So there is a less risk of an environmental disaster. Now the oil reserves in Brazil are open to foreign corporations, and there is much less regulation, and the risk of environmental disaster in offshore oil exploitation is also very high. And at the same time, President Dilma has created a fund to invest in education, so all the royalties from the new oil reserves will be invested in education. So all of that was dismantled after the coup. Now we have very much less investments in social programs, in education, in healthcare. We have a situation where we had the unemployment rate in Brazil at that time was 4%, and now it's 15%.
Wow.
So we have an economic crisis that is not going to get better and privatization and structural adjustment policies are only going to make the economic crisis even worse. First of all, it's about the U.S. getting control over natural resources in Latin America, mining resources, oil, also water and land is also a target. The Amazon is a target as well of multinational corporations. At the same time, they want to have economic control and have the IMF go back as happened. We already saw that happening in Argentina. Also, people have to understand is that in the case of Venezuela, there is a high risk of civil war. So we can bring the type of very bloody, catastrophic war to the Americas. And I think people in this country need to understand, even if they don't understand the situation in Venezuela, even, you know, we know there is a huge amount of media manipulation about Venezuela, but even if it's difficult for people to understand, just, you know, the arguments that bring a war to the region, I think, needs to get people to mobilize against this, the U.S. intervention.
Heaven wrote a really important article. One of the things that he laid out, U.S.-led coup, which is unusually open and propagated by every single solitary media outlet. It is an absolute full.
I think one of the responsibilities of activists is to overcome the false media narrative, and inform others and build a new political narrative that overcomes the mass media and the bipartisans in Washington, D.C. So the article you talked about was our weekly newsletter, and we wrote it in response actually to a Bernie Sanders comment on Venezuela. He put out a two-paragraph comment. The first three sentences were all factually wrong, saying Venezuela is not a democracy, that socialism had run the economy into the ground, and that the Venezuela government was killing nonviolent protesters. Just false statement after false statement. He concluded with the right conclusion, that we should not intervene. But we used his comments as the outline for the first part of the article and reviewed the myths that were being told. So, but that's just, ours is just one of many. There's so many good articles out there now. I think our job is really to use our social media, our networks, the organizations we're involved in, our email lists, our Facebook, Twitter, you know, to really overwhelm the false report. And I think we can do that. And so I think once we start to do that, the narrative will switch. Then our responsibility is to demand that any military action, because our previous comment was right, a war in Venezuela is a possibility. That any military action must go through Congress, and Congress under the Constitution is the part of government that has the power to declare war, and they need congressional authorization to take that kind of military action. So we need to make this a public debate and change the narrative,
Kevin,
by using our
one of the things to help change the narrative. I just want to take us back to May 20th, 2018, when President Nicolas Maduro was reelected, and the response to the allegations of unfair elections. Now, you were actually there. So help us begin the process of debunking some of the mythology that is being put out.
Well, I was there for the election, for a while before that, and was impressed by the quality of their electoral system. I'm not alone in that. Jimmy Carter has said it's the best electoral system in the world. They do some things that no other country does, and certainly some things the U.S. doesn't do. For example, just from the foundational issue, in the United States, there is no constitutional right to vote. In Venezuela, there is. And that really changes everything. If you have a right to vote, all these shenanigans we see in U.S. elections, you know, restricting voter registration, not providing enough election machines, long voting lines, that would not be allowed if it was actually our right to vote. In Venezuela, it is, and therefore they have a very different approach right from the beginning. But the beginning is one part, but the end is what really got me the most impressed was at the end of election day, they do something no other country does. They have a people's audit where they do a public recount of every precinct has to do a random selection of 52% of the machines and publicly check the ballot. They do both a
paper ballot that's voter verified and put in the ballot box and a machine count. And they take the paper ballots and read them one by one, lift the ballot up, show it to everybody watching. All the political parties are there. It's videotaped. The public and media can watch. They read the ballots one by one, take a tally of all the votes by hand, compare that to the machine count to determine if the machine is working properly or not. That is pretty impressive. It's so hard to get an audit or a recount in the United States that we can learn a great deal from that. And my the only allegation of why this was not a legitimate election is because 46% of the people turned out. Maduro won 67% of the vote. That's a low turnout for Venezuela. It's a little bit lower than the U.S., but not much. And the reason for a low turnout was because there was a boycott. The opposition knew they would lose the election. And under U.S. pressure, they were told not to vote. Maduro would have won with a full turnout as well, and the opposition knew that. So this is a legitimate democracy. He's a legitimate president. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows – Venezuela Constitution that allows this. That's a nonsensical argument we can go into if you have time. But this is a false coup president that must be rejected, and our job as activists is to make that clear.
And Roger Wareham, you in your capacity with the International Association Against Torture, et cetera, helped author a letter. I want you to talk about the content of that letter.
We sent a letter to the U.N. Secretary General and a copy to the President of the General Assembly, which is Ecuador, of all countries at this time, challenging the U.N. Secretary General to take the lead in denouncing the U.S. intervention on the basis that, one, it violates the Charter of the United Nations, which prohibits intervention in the internal affairs of a sovereign state, which Venezuela is, and that the Secretary General needs to take whatever steps necessary to prevent that from happening, from continuing. And then it also refers to, in terms of international law, the International Court of Justice, which had a decision back in 1986 when the U.S. had interfered once again in Nicaragua. And in their decision, the International Court of Justice says that the principle of non-intervention involves the right of every sovereign state to conduct its affairs without outside interference. And then it also later talks about the Nicaragua decision had made it clear that the principle of non-intervention prohibits a state to intervene directly or indirectly with or without armed force in support of the internal opposition within the state, which is precisely what the United States is doing now. So we're asking people to sign on to that letter if they want. We can get them copies. If they email us at D12M, that's the letters D, the numbers 12M at AOL.com, we'll get you a copy of the letter. We're going to have it up on our website, which is D12M.com for people to sign on to of international law. And at the same time, in the letter, we refer to some of the different interventions that the United States has done in Nicaragua, the 2001 sabotage of the petroleum industry, the 2002 aborted coup d'etat against President Chavez, the 15-year campaign of Minda Kevin and popular resistance, the newsletter, and I think the thing they did around facts people need to know. It's an excellent compendium of what's going on in Venezuela. But the 15-year campaign to engineer commodity shortages in Venezuela, the 2014 La Salida exit campaign of organized violent street protests, President Obama's official declaration of Venezuela as a threat to U.S. national security, the 2015 Operation Jericho attempted a violent military coup against President Maduro. That's what the letter talks about. It puts it in the context of all the different violations and interventions by the U.S. So we can make it very clear who is the criminal in this scenario. It is not President Maduro. It is not the government of Venezuela. It certainly is the U.S. and its allies.
But I just want to go back for a moment to Brazil, and I'm thinking about what's happening in the Brazilian Amazon. Companies like Archer Daniels Midland and Bungie, which are American-based companies, the agribusiness, in particular the soy and beef production, which is a leading driver of forest loss and human rights abuses in the Brazilian Amazon. I wonder if you can talk about that, companies like, for that matter, BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard, how that draws Bolsonaro and his ideology towards the U.S.
In Brazil, you have a caucus in Congress that is very powerful, that is formed by rural elite, old oligarchs. That, you know, Brazil is the country that has the greatest concentration of farmland in the world. We never had an agrarian reform, and of course, you know, we have very strong movements like the landless workers movement in Brazil that has been struggling for agrarian reform for years. The most problems, you know, urban and rural problems of poverty, inequality, hunger in Brazil are a result of land inequality. We have dozens of people who are killed every year in land conflicts, you know, peasants, indigenous people that have been killed by this rural militia group. Those are very powerful forces in Congress, and the local elites have very strong ties with multinational agribusiness corporations like Bunge, Cargill, and ADM, and Monsanto. And now, after the election of Bolsonaro, he's saying that he's going to open up millions of hectares of land in the Amazon to expand soybean production, a huge amount of environmental devastation in Brazil. It displaces rural communities. It destroys the land, the soil, the water sources, but also creates debt because agribusiness in Brazil receives a great deal of state subsidies. So what they produce is actually debt. When you do the counting, they claim that they contribute to the GDP, to the gross domestic product. But when you compare the amount of subsidies and unpaid debt, you see that what they leave is, you know, a financial crisis and environmental destruction. So this is the result of expanding agribusiness.
I want to give a final comment to Kevin Zeese and also to then Roger to take us to, I know, which is we've got to be in the street. Kevin and then Roger.
Well, yes, I think in the streets is important, and it's already happening. And the people of Venezuela are noticing our solidarity with them in the streets. We have a slider on the top of popularresistance.org that we will continually update with links to more protests that people can get involved with. This is going to be an ongoing process. I just want people to know that we can stop a military intervention, that we are on the right side of this issue and on the right side of history. I think the points about international law are right on. I'd be happy to sign that letter, by the way. I think that we need to bring it to that level as well, because already the OAS, which is under the thumb of the United States, has refused to recognize this fake president and refused intervention into Venezuela. And so I think we are going to win this battle, but we need to be organized, educated, organized, and mobilized. So please stay on top of that. Check out our slider on popular resistance at the top of the page to get involved. Thanks for having this show.
Thank you. Roger Wareham, Secretary General of the International Association Against Torture, member of the December 12th movement. Where do we go? How do we translate this into activism?
A demonstration to voice our outrage with the conduct of the country that supposedly, ostensibly represents our interests, which we know is not true. For more information, your listening audience can call 718-398-1766, 718-398-1766. This is really important that we take a stand, that we let the world know that what Trump's foreign policy is not the foreign policy of the people of the United States.
Roger Wareham, Secretary General of the International Association Against Torture, member of the December 12th meeting, Kevin Zeese, lawyer, political activist, co-director of Popular Resistance, Maria Luisa Mendonca, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, looking deeper at our work as anti-colonialists, anti-imperialists, and clearly we've got to kind of sharpen our tools on that, get into the streets, sign the letters, do what we have to. Thank you all for joining us.
has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
Since the founding of our nation,
U.S. President Donald Trump at this week's annual National Prayer Breakfast.
Many of our greatest strides, from gaining our independence to abolition of civil rights, have been led by people of faith and started in prayer.
While our rights are under threat and the sanctity of identities is in peril, let me be clear. The state of our union is strong.
I'm totally influenced by 80s new wave music. There's no way around that. Everybody can tell.
When I get old, I want you by my side.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Poland's gay politician springs into action, Pose star snaps at Trump's State of the Union, and words on romance to Tate's synth-pop beat. Those stories and more this week because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 9th, 2019. The legal recognition of same-gender couples, equal pay for women, better access to reproductive rights, including abortion, and universal old-age pensions. That's on the agenda of a new progressive political party in Poland called Spring. Spring is led by Robert Biedron, the country's first out politician. He describes himself on his website as a person who is often swimming against the tide, one who can unite people. The 42-year-old former mayor of Slupsk and member of parliament wants to challenge the governing right-wing Law and Justice Party in both domestic and European Union elections this year. Charging that both sides of the political divide in Poland have let us down, Biedron told a rally of several thousand people in Warsaw this week that we need a spring that will renew this gloomy landscape. He's also taking on the country's politically powerful Roman Catholic Church, promising to reduce their influence on how Poland is governed. Biedron's previous political affiliations include the Social Democracy of the Republic of Poland Party and the Democratic Left Alliance. He helped launch the country's campaign against homophobia in 2001. On his website, Biedron promised to always be myself. I'm a politician who loves Poland, he wrote, and said that he is focused on the sustainable development of a modern, honest state that provides equal opportunities for all, supports education and culture, and ensures security.
A bipartisan group of U.S. senators and representatives has introduced a bill in both chambers to protect currently serving transgender service members from Donald Trump and to continue to allow qualified trans people to enlist in the U.S. Armed Forces. It's obviously a direct challenge to the president's effort to ban their enlistment and to discharge honorably serving trans personnel, and comes just a few weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court lifted most of the court injunctions preventing the trans ban from taking effect. However, without explanation, the justices allowed one injunction to remain. The Trump administration is expected to challenge that final barrier to implementation of the ban in a Maryland federal court. The sponsors in the Senate include Democrats Kirsten Gillibrand of New York and Jack Reed of Rhode Island, and Republican Susan Collins of Maine. Sponsors in the House include Democrat Jackie Speier of California, joined by Massachusetts Democrat Joseph Kennedy, New York Republican John Katko, California Democrat Susan Davis, and Maryland Democrat Anthony Brown. Our transgender service members put their lives on the line every day despite an ill-advised edict from the president, said Speier in a press release. A Gillibrand press release called Trump's efforts an insult to the brave and patriotic transgender Americans who choose to serve in our military. Meanwhile, Major General Matthew Beavers of the California National Guard is also publicly challenging Trump's proposed ban. He told qualified transgender troops through remarks to a state legislative committee this week that, as long as you fight, we don't care what gender you identify as, adding that nobody's going to kick you out.
But the Arkansas State Supreme Court has ruled that the city of Fayetteville cannot enforce its LGBTQ-inclusive anti-bias ordinance. The city wanted the ordinance to take effect while it challenges the constitutionality of an Arkansas statute that prevents local jurisdictions from enacting any anti-discrimination protections that are not also embedded in state law. There are no anti-bias protections for LGBTQ people in Arkansas. A lower court had allowed the ordinance to remain in effect until the constitutionality issue has been resolved. Fayetteville is a college town, a relatively progressive oasis in the state. The LGBTQ inclusive ordinance, passed by the City Council in 2015, was subsequently challenged and then ultimately ratified by the voters. The state's highest court ruled in 2017 that the Fayetteville measure violated Arkansas law. However, the late January High Court decision simply reaffirmed the 2017 ruling and left open the question of the law's constitutionality. Fayetteville City Attorney Kit Williams told the Associated Press that he will ask the High Court to reconsider its ruling. It seems very strange, he said, that they would deny us the right to at least present that constitutional argument to them for their decision.
LGBTQ people and their allies in Mumbai have celebrated their first pride since India's Supreme Court overturned the onerous Penal Code Section 377, the colonial-era criminalization of adult queer sex. A record crowd, estimated at about 15,000 people, danced down the streets in the joyous and colorful procession. Mumbai is India's most populous city. Parade co-organizer Ankit Buptani told Gay Star News that it was the first time in a Mumbai Pride parade where no one was wearing masks. The New Freedom also encouraged first-time parade entries by professional associations ranging from medical to educational, plus contingents representing national and multinational companies. 3 or 4 years ago, there were people shouting at us that homosexuals are going to hell, Buptani said. There were no anti-queer protesters along the parade route this year. A record number of people participated in the first post-377 Pride Parade last November in Delhi. Next on the agenda of India's LGBTQ community, national anti-discrimination laws, full recognition of the rights of transgender and intersex people, and marriage equality.
The fallout from the election of a far-right proud homophobe to the presidency of Brazil continues. Jair Bolsonaro used an anti-corruption platform to win election, despite his frequent, blatantly racist, sexist, and homophobic public remarks. Bolsonaro once said that he'd prefer a dead son to a gay son. Anti-queer violence has sharply escalated since the election. The critically acclaimed U.S. film Boy Erased had been scheduled for release across Brazil in January and February. LGBTQ activists were excited about a movie taking a sharp look at so-called gay conversion therapy, but were disappointed by a statement released this week that distributor Universal Pictures would not be releasing Boy Erased after all. The statement claimed that the cancellation was solely and exclusively for commercial reasons based on the cost of the launch campaign compared to the estimated box office sales. Queer conversion therapy does big business in Brazil, something the Bolsonaro regime most likely supports, if only tacitly. Brazilian activist Leandro Ramos told Reuters that the distributor's decision is a little irresponsible, particularly in a country like Brazil, where conversion therapy is still such an epidemic, and in a moment when you have an openly anti-LGBT administration in place. Universal Pictures said the film, starring Nicole Kidman and featuring out singer Troy Sivan, will be released for home viewing, though it didn't say when. Meanwhile, in a late-breaking story this week, the Associated Press is reporting that the Bolsonaro administration is planning to remove all references to feminism, violence against women, and same-gender attraction in school textbooks across Brazil. The scheme would also have the military take over some public schools. The president of one of the country's largest teachers' unions, Nilton Brandao, said that we are still waiting to see how, in practice, all this is going to turn out. Right now, it does not make any sense.
And finally, two different studies of queer parents released this week revealed the homo superiority of children raised by same-gender couples. One study by Belgian economists used government tracking data of children born in the Netherlands between 1995 and 2005. It found that kids raised by same-gender parents had higher test scores in elementary and secondary school and were about 7% more likely to graduate from high school than children raised by the traditional mother and father. The study followed 1,200 children who were being raised by queer couples and more than a million kids raised by heterosexual couples. The Netherlands was chosen by the researchers because it has a long history of support for LGBTQ people. According to the Washington Post, the results announced this week echo a 2014 study in Australia that found children in same-gender-headed households to be generally happier and healthier than their peers. One theory about the difference is that lesbian and gay couples tend to share parenting responsibilities more equally.
Another new study released this week comes from Canada. A researcher at the University of Montreal has found that gay dads make wonderful parents. Eric Fuget observed 46 families consisting of 92 gay fathers and 46 children between the ages of 1 and 9 over the course of 7 years for his doctoral thesis. Fuget said he wanted to see how the fathers distributed parental work. He found that gay dads tend to share parental responsibilities fairly equally and are generally more engaged in child-rearing than their heterosexual parental counterparts. Fuget also discovered that gay fathers are less encumbered by notions of masculinity and femininity in parenting roles and could variously be playmates, caregivers, protectors, role models, and morality guides. He said it's not a question of sex, even less so of sexual orientation. It's a question of the roles occupied when caring for a child and the time spent with the child.
That's NewsWrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending February 9th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm John Dyer V.
My brother and I started our first band when I was in college, and we thought we were pretty good, so at some point I thought I should move to L.A. and try to be in a band here.
Devin Tate's Road to Valentine's Day, later in the program.
A hail to the chief, he's your buddy and your neighbor.
My budget will ask Democrats and Republicans to make the needed commitment to eliminate the HIV epidemic in the United States within 10 years. We have made incredible strides. Incredible.
That's what he said, but did he mean it? It was the closest U.S. President Donald Trump came to saying anything about the LGBTQ community in his February 5th State of the Union address, and activists doubt that even that tangential reference can be taken seriously. On the surface, Trump's vow to stop HIV in 10 years was commendable, but critics say that beyond the surface, it was a pledge without a plan. Certainly no such plan is in the works by the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. In December of 2017, the administration abruptly fired all of the council members who had not already resigned, and two new co-chairs were appointed only recently. Trump's promise is also not supported by his last two budget proposals, which have slashed funding for HIV/AIDS research and programs. Among AIDS activists, the highest priority for combating the disease is the protection of the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid, two of the Republicans' favorite targets. The only official mention of specifically queer concerns on State of the Union night came from Democratic respondent Stacey Abrams, the former state legislator who made an impressive run for governor of Georgia.
We affirmed marriage equality, and yet the LGBTQ community remains under attack.
What the official speeches lacked was made up for by Poe star Billy Porter in his own State of the Queer Union address.
Hello. I'm here with Logo to offer up the LGBTQ State of Our Union, reflect on the past year, and look forward to the year ahead. While our rights are under threat and the sanctity of identities is in peril, let me be clear. The state of our union is strong. Last month, we celebrated the legacy of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Each year, we offer up Dr. King's inspiring quotes, but it's crucial that we take the time to consider what they really mean. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. As LGBTQ people, we face hate every day due to the simple fact of our existence. The Human Rights Campaign reported that in 2018, no fewer than 29 transgender souls, mostly trans women of color, lost their light to violence. We will try to do right by them, to say their names, so that their deaths may not be in vain. According to the Anti-Violence Project, the severity of hate violence against LGBTQ people is increasing. And as the attack on our brother Jussie Smollett shows, violence can touch our lives, no matter who knows your name. How do we fight this hate? With love. We must continue to demonstrate our love for each other. Love is strength, strength we must have to fight for our integrity and for our very lives. We will fight hate with solidarity by standing up for our siblings around the world. We stand with our siblings in Chechnya, where a crackdown on the LGBT community has resulted in 40 people being detained in recent months and at least two being killed. We will stand with our siblings in Brazil, where a rash of anti-queer violence has been compounded by the presidential election of a far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, who has a history of homophobic, racist, and sexist comments. In the words of Bayard Rustin, Dr. King's brother in the struggle for civil rights, when an individual is protesting society's refusal to acknowledge his dignity as a human being, his very act of protest confers dignity on him. And we will fight hate with our voices. We are living with an administration that is seeking to erase our very existence, but we won't let them. We must loudly and proudly declare we are here through the banning of transgender service members. We are here through the violence enacted by hate speech. We are here. And if the victories of the last year prove anything, we ain't going no damn where. In November of this past year, America elected the most diverse Congress in history, with a record number of LGBTQ candidates seeking and winning office. On TV, on film, and in music, we are showing up and showing out. From Janelle Monáe snatching an Album of the Year Grammy nomination for her queer magnum opus, Dirty Computer, to the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences, serving us the queerest Best Picture nominees in its 90-plus year history, to the groundbreaking show Pose, giving voice to a community often silenced. We are in front of and behind the cameras, and increasingly, we are the authors of our own stories. Looking forward, 2019 promises to be a year of celebration. This summer, on the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion, the United States will host World Pride for the first time in New York City. We will continue to carry on the legacies of our elders, of Marsha P. and Sylvia, of Baldwin and Bayard, of Harvey, Larry, and Miss Major. We will continue to come together to acknowledge and embrace our intersectional community and to push for equality and justice for all. Though darkness may seem to overshadow the progress we've made, we must not let it snuff our light out. Love will and love must keep us united. Only with the strength from love can we continue to forge ahead. Make no mistake, our best days are ahead of us. Onward and upward. God bless our LGBT community, and God bless the United States of America.
That was actor, singer, activist Billy Porter on the state of the queer union.
God, die. Hey, everybody, this is Leah Delaria, and you are listening to This Way Out.
Won't you come and see us?
You supply the chocolates, and we'll supply the hot-off-the-presses queer love song.
I'm Maddie McLaughlin for This Way Out. Valentine's Day falls smack dab in the middle of every February, literally and figuratively, the calendar month's hump day. Loved by those in love, while dreaded by the lovelorn. If a dose of hope and optimism is what you're looking for to get you through Black Thursday this year, the sophomore solo release by LA-based synth-pop songsmith Devin Tate may be just the box of chocolates you need. Recently, I sat down with Devin to discuss his new album, Art Damage, collaborating with LGBT icon Wendy Ho, and his musical musings on love and plans for a successful and satisfying Valentine's Day. Devin, welcome to This Way Out.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your history.
I originally came from Kansas. I grew up on a farm. My brother and I started our first band when I was in college, and we thought we were pretty good, so at some point I thought I should move to LA and try to be in a band here. Actually, when I first moved here, I kind of thought I was going to be in a boy band.
Step one.
We can have lots of fun.
Step two.
I thought it would be really fun, and I could meet other guys, and so I enrolled in a class at Learning Tree University up in Chatsworth called Hip Hop and Funk Dancing. And I realized that probably wasn't going to happen. And that's when I met Amy Crosby and Vaughn. They started this band, which at the time they called Short Hair Girls Club. And I said, oh, well, I play keyboards. Could I maybe, like, come over when you rehearse? So I kind of weaseled my way in with them. That's when we kind of decided, hey, let's call it Glitter. Amy's cat was, like, trying to eat some tinsel wig on the floor. So that's where the name came from. In Glitter, we did 3 albums. We were reviewed in Out Magazine, all the local LA magazines. We did a little tour. We played Iceland Gay Pride, Winnipeg Gay Pride, San Francisco, San Diego, Albuquerque, LA. We did the Queer Media Conference in New York. So we had a really busy year. I think that was 2006. That was kind of our biggest year, I think. It kind of all fell apart after 2008. That's when I went solo. I had a solo album come out in 2011. And then after I released my album, I wanted to play it out live, so I needed a band. So that's how I formed Devin Tate and the Traitors. And then I realized I wanted to have all the control again. So that's when I kind of started working on this solo album.
We're out on the range, and isn't it strange? It's like a dream where I forgot to get dressed.
Who are your musical influences?
I'm totally influenced by 80s new wave music. There's no way around that. Everybody can tell. Human League is my favorite band and has been since I was really little. Also, Tiffany was like my diva. She's my original OG diva from back in the day. I love Duran Duran. Anything Thompson Twins, B-52s, Devo, Sugar Cubes. Anything from the 80s that was on MTV. MTV was like my one link to kind of this other world that I didn't see anywhere near me, but I could see it on my TV every day.
Now, you're artist and co-producer on this album, and as co-producer, you've chosen to include some bright new talents on the songs.
There are a lot of tracks where I have vocalists I sing with. One in particular, Raisa. She's been singing backup with Demi Lovato. I think she was on The Voice or one of those big TV shows. Really happy to feature her on this album. I'm so in love with her voice.
You still have to fight for what's right. You still have to stand.
The song Anyone Can Break Somebody's Heart is a real highlight. It's definitely going to heat up the dance floors. And it features LGBT friend and music comedy giant Wendy Ho. How'd that collaboration come about?
I had a project where I worked with Tammy Brown and Kelly Mantle from RuPaul's Drag Race. We had a band called Rolls Royces. That never really went anywhere because I never really finished producing the EP that we were working on. Maybe someday. But then I was going to see Tammy Brown at Hamburger Mary's and Wendy Hill was there. And I just said, hey, would you want to work on a song together? And she said, sure, hon. You know, we're both from the Kansas City area. She spent a lot of her youth in Kansas City. So we kind of had that connection. It seems like every year at LA Pride, like, I get like a good idea for a song title. A few years ago, I had the idea for one of my songs on my band album, which was To Be Young and on Downers. A year or two after that, I was at Pride, and I just thought, anyone can break somebody's heart. Basically, it's just like, you know, you can't be too cautious with somebody, you know, like if you're afraid that they're going to break your heart. Well, anybody could do that. So you just need to go ahead and follow your heart, even if it's going to get broken.
There's a really visceral earnestness to your love songs. It's very sweet, particularly in the song By My Side. Tell me about that.
You know, for me, I'm a very sensitive person and I need a lot of support and a lot of love and a lot of help. So I do want to give Dylan, my husband, credit for that. And so By My Side is kind of a song that I wrote about him to thank him, kind of about our relationship and our marriage. Because he always says that I don't write songs about him, although it's not true. Maybe I just don't tell him which ones are about him, but this one I kind of dedicated to him.
How will you two be spending Valentine's Day? And do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, don't put too much emphasis on it. Really, the best Valentine's Days are the ones that you don't plan anything and you just kind of like go with the flow. For years, my husband and I would try to go out to some restaurant and like have that stereotypical Valentine's date, and it just never felt that satisfying. We went to a play one time about Leopold and Loeb. That was actually, I think, my favorite Valentine's Day ever. So yeah, we tried to do something kind of un-Valentine's Day. Last year, we actually did a bar crawl in Hollywood to a bunch of like kind of dive bars and just had a few drinks everywhere we went. So that was really fun.
Well, I'm going to recommend snuggling over some In-N-Out burgers while streaming your new record, Art Damage. Thank you so much for being with us, Devin.
Thank you.
Best of luck with the album.
Thank you so much.
For This Way Out, I'm Maddie McLaughlin.
As soon as Devin Tate's Anyone Can Break Somebody's Heart video drops this week, you'll be able to see it at thiswayout.org. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from John Dyer V and Sarah Sweeney, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Maddie McLaughlin. Devin Tate performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WIOFLP and workforcerising.com, Woodstock, New York, HCCC Alice Springs, Northern Territory, CKUW Winnipeg, Manitoba, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We live in a society consumed by worry about our personal happiness. Are we joyful enough? And if we're not, what can we do about it individually? Governments take stock of our levels of contentment. There's a burgeoning field of science focusing on happiness, and an even larger industry selling products and strategies for being more happy as individuals. But what if, as Lynn Siegel argues, our apparent misery can't be alleviated just on an individual, atomized level? What if we need to reclaim the joy that comes from being together with others and even creating things collectively for the better? Siegel, a veteran of the women's movement in the UK, is professor of psychology and gender studies at the Department of Psychosocial Studies at Birkbeck College in London and the author of Radical Happiness, Moments of Collective Joy. That's published by Verso. Lynn, I'd like to begin by asking you why you think there's such a focus on happiness in recent decades.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because particularly from the 1990s, at least in Britain, we actually appointed a happiness czar. And the strange thing about this is it seems to be a time when everyone is actually getting more and more unhappy. And in fact, the radical czar we appointed was called Richard Layard. And he'd just written a book on depression, saying that depression was the biggest danger to people in this country at the moment, and in particular the biggest danger to businesses. So I think it's actually the happiness agenda sort of doubles as a misery agenda. The hidden title, I think, is that it's a misery agenda, and we've all got to work out how to get over our own misery and become happier. I think that's the problem, that the hidden agenda is how miserable we are. And it doesn't quite want to ask, why are we all so miserable? What it wants to do is say, well, now it's up to you, each and every one of you, to put on that smiling face and make yourself happy.
Why do you think businesses would care if we're happy or not?
Well, actually, they lose a lot of time, people taking off work, because they are so depressed. And there really is a big loss to business. It's been worked out as the estimated loss is $12 billion, I've been told. That is 1% of national income. Now, that's in Britain. If it's $12 billion in Britain, you can imagine what it is in the States. So, you know, it really does seem that people's unhappiness is a big problem. And, of course, to me, that's what we should be asking about. Why are people so unhappy? And, of course, part of my answer is we can't just look at this as an individual problem, because actually depression rates have been rising all around the world. They probably rise fastest in the USA, actually. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's also where there's the biggest consumption of antidepressant tablets. So there's lots of little pills around to keep us happy. But somehow, more and more people, about 1 in 4 overall, are needing to take these little pills. So, you know, something is going wrong. And I wanted to ask other questions about what might be going wrong. So that's why I wrote my book, Radical Happiness, to try and think differently about the question of happiness. And as I say, what lies underneath that, which is the realities of so much personal misery around.
How do we know how happy we are? I mean, there's obviously a big industry around selling us things around it, including pharmaceutical drugs. But how do we actually know? And how do we define happiness?
Sure. Well, that is the big question that I spend a lot of time trying to understand in Radical Happiness. And I go right back to Aristotle and his view of eudaimonia. And this is about people's relationship to the world. But I think what's happened now is that we've so internalized everything that we think of happiness as some purely internal state. And so the fact that we find here in Britain, and I'm sure you find there in the US, that there's huge correlations between unemployment and precarious jobs, between homelessness and the gig economy, and who's suffering most from depression. That sort of is pushed aside for the idea that we simply have to put on a smiley face and work out how to be happier. My view is that happiness, like misery, because I see them sort of two sides of exactly the same coin, happiness, like misery, has to be seen as much as a social as a personal or individual factor. And so once you see it like that, then you're asking different questions and you're doing different things. You're not just trying to quantify people's reactions to a questionnaire, how happy were you yesterday, but you're asking much more generally about when in their lives they felt happiest, what they think can keep them most happy, and then I think, you know, their relationship to other people, their relationship to jobs, their relationship to their families, you know, all those issues come in. And that's what I'm thinking about when I talk about moments of collective joy. Moments of collective joy are those times in life when we can just relax and forget about ourselves for the moment and be together with other people and feel happy together. And I think those are the moments that last longest as well, because we've shared them and we can keep on sharing them. So I've got a lot to say about that. I've got a lot to say about how lucky I was to come into adulthood in the 60s, to be a part of, you know, a very hopeful moment in history when we really thought that together we could change things. So as a woman, you know, as part of the women's liberation movement, we were really not necessarily personally confident, but we did feel that we could somehow make our mark on the world together. And that's the sort of thing that I said Hannah Arendt talks about in introducing the notion of public happiness. And my idea of radical happiness comes from your poet, Adrian Rich, who uses Arendt's notion of public happiness to talk about radical happiness. And Hannah Arendt actually thought that no one could really be said to be happy or societies to be healthy unless they had a sense of their place in the world, unless they felt able to take part collectively with others in the world. So that idea of public happiness was the sense that, you know, our lives had a meaning together with others, by participating with others in the world. And that's what I said Adrian Rich takes up to talk about radical happiness, thinking, you know, in particular, when we can get away, as I said, from that gloomy tyrant, the self. We can get away from monitoring ourselves, having to keep that smiling face, forget about ourselves for the moment, and lose ourselves with others in the world. Now, we might be losing ourselves in our job, in creativity, in admiring the landscape. But it is usually, even if we're doing things all alone, what's going to remain with us, I think, is the account we give to other people. You know, how, you know, our love of flowers, our love of countryside, insofar as we can share that, share it with others, share it with our children, share it with friends. But it seems to me, they're the moments we remember as happy moments.
Well, it's interesting because there has been in recent years attention paid to the value from a perspective of public health of friendship, mm-hmm. that people who are socially isolated, who are lonely, and mm-hmm. Much sicker than people who are not. So social supports, there's a focus on that as having a value in society. But what's missing from what you've just described, those sort of collective moments of joy that people can experience, including in moments of political ferment and collective action, is not simply being with others, although you're clearly saying that's important, but the notion that you're creating something new together. Can you talk about that dimension of collective joy?
Yes. But maybe just before I do that, I would like to point out that a lot of the spaces for collective life, for people coming together, certainly in Britain and I think in the USA, have been closed down. There's less recreational spaces.
Sure.
More and more spaces are taken over for commercial ends, and you actually have to pay to go to them and so on. You have to pay to go to your rock concerts. You don't just have a free festival and so on. So I maybe will return to that. But why I think I have stressed somehow our meaningful engagement with others in the world. It's partly my own political commitments, but it's also looking around, getting this a sense of fulfillment because your life has meaning. It gives extra meaning to your life. So, you know, I do think, for instance, as young people involved in Black Lives Matter, or here we have Sisters Uncut and so on, people whose lives have been very tough and frightened and miserable, coming together to say that we're going to change things. I think that can give you a real sense of agency. A sense of shared agency. If you can have a sense of shared agency again, it's likely to be stronger. And also, even when you fail, you're failing together with others and think, but we can try that again. So there's something about being able to share with others, I think, that gives your life more meaning. Because I think individually, for instance, if we don't reach the aspirations we have, we just get this strong sense of personal failure. You know, that personal failure quickly becomes personal misery. It can actually become a sense of guilt. Your well-known writer, Barbara Ehrenreich, writes a lot about that when she's in her book Smile or Die, or various other works that she's written, also Dancing in the Streets, where she points out that the whole stress on happiness as something simply personal makes people feel guilty who are not feeling happy. You know, so unless we can get outside of that, you know, it's just up to me how I feel. I have to change everything to make my life happy. I think that's as likely as not, more likely than not, to create again what another of your writers, Lauren Berlant, calls cruel optimism, the idea that you really can personally create your own good fortune. And that's a very, very hard thing, and getting harder all the time as actually our societies are becoming more unequal. So the reason to look outwards then, and look outwards politically, is that I think it's there that you can generate a hope that things could be different. And even if they're not as you want them to be, you can work together, thinking about what visions you have for how things could be different. And yeah, that's why people talk about the commons. It's why, you know, certainly in moments of people taking to the streets for whatever reason, like the pink pussy hats and so on after the election of your president, everyone is smiling. I mean, only last year there were 5 million women on the streets in Spain on International Women's Day. Now, all of them smiling because they have this sense of being together, and, you know, the world isn't as we want it, but maybe together we can try and change it. And even if we fail, we can together keep trying. I mean, failing is serious, but the sense of being together with others, that's what lasts, I think.
I'm speaking with Lynn Siegel about her book, Radical Happiness, Moments of Collective Joy. It's published by Verso, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, the kind of communal joy that you're describing, of coming together, trying to change things together, being together, is certainly something that doesn't tend to be celebrated in our societies. Or if it does, it is in quite different ways. There are, of course, people who come together religiously and can experience some kind of collective sense of joy. There are people who come together for their sports teams, but by and large, that kind of collective coming together of people with the agenda of radically changing society is certainly less celebrated. And I wanted to ask you about how, in the West, collectivity, just putting aside religion for a moment, has been seen, especially around the notion of the crowd and the rabble.
I don't at all dismiss religion or other ways in which people come together and experience joy. They are often rather top-down situations. You have a leader who's, you know, who's guiding you. But I don't dismiss that at all. But the interesting thing is that particularly after there's been moments of collective protest of almost revolutionary upheaval, such as the French Revolution and the Paris Commune that happened 100 years later. It's precisely after that you get what I see as a strong conservative voice saying how dangerous the crowd is, how very dangerous the crowd is. Crowds will always tend to create violence. Crowds will always tend towards a sort of, as it were, uncivilized wildness. And really, there's very little evidence of that for the most part. For the most part, crowds have just been given a very, very bad name. And there are many times when people come together in which they're just experiencing a type of joy which is spreading, becoming contagious, going from person to person. That's what Adrienne Rich described when she went to read her poetry after the fall of Pinochet, and she gives lots of accounts of when people have a sense of achievement that, you know, this is what we wanted and this is what we've got. And and then they're, you know, together in huge numbers, but listening to each other, listening out for each other, and so on. And I wanted to contrast that moment with the image that's in the notion of the crowd, of this very negative thing, which to me ties in with all the dystopic accounts we get of the present. And if you think of what the most popular movies have been, of what's on television and so on, you can think of Blade Runner, where even daylight is rationed and violence everywhere, or you think of The Hunger Game or Handmaid's Tale. All these things are, you know, creating images of oppression and disaster and catastrophe looming, which I think people have very, very strongly an image of catastrophe looming. And that is obviously what Naomi Klein writes about in, you know, This Changes Everything. It is the case that there are real dangers and risks ahead. But then there's also, you know, what Rebecca Solnit and other people write about, there's also the ways in which we come together, and you can call it a crowd or not a crowd, we come together, though, and just in that coming together, thinking, but it doesn't have to be like that. We don't have to accept all these dystopic images. We do have to think about how we can create better lives, more caring lives, and a sustainable future, a sustainable world. And that, you know, if we're going to dismiss collective action as sort of bad crowd behavior, then we're just going to all have our individual anxieties about the future without ever thinking that perhaps things could be different. You know, people love to quote now, that originally came from Frederick Jameson, you've probably heard, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Well, I don't know if we can imagine the end of capitalism, but what we can imagine, certainly we can imagine the end of the world, and we're being presented with images of that all the time. But it does seem to me also we could put our minds to imagining how to create more sustainable futures, how to have better working conditions, how to actually create jobs and so on that felt more meaningful to people, you know, how to roll back, it seems to me, what have been some of the worst choices that have been made by governments in allowing the market to rule all in the name of corporate profits. And that's really what's happened over the last 30 to 40 years. There's been a huge tolerance and an invitation of the market into what was previously controlled by local communities, by the state, not sort of wonderfully or brilliantly, but nevertheless creating possibilities which become tougher and tougher if we don't value the importance of public life, of public resources, of democratic frameworks in which people can be saying what types of communities they want. So that's why, you know, I want to turn around all this negativity around crowds to say, actually, if, you know, democracy is about collectivity. Democracy, and particularly the sorts of participatory democracy that my generation were always stressing, which is, you know, you don't just vote once every 3 or 5 years, but you try to be responsible for your immediate surroundings and then, you know, for wider and wider surroundings. So, you know, no is not enough, as Naomi Klein says, because we can do more, and we can do more together. And so that, yeah, that's the sort of thing that I'm writing about in Radical Happiness. Of course, it's the sort of thing I've always written about, and you have a lot of people over there who've been writing similar things, whom I've mentioned, like Barbara Ehrenreich, like Rebecca Solnit, and so many others. You know, who's like, I don't know, it's almost like keeping faith with the future, actually, a future that we can help to shape and not just a future that is forced upon us by saying there is no alternative but to, you know, allow the market to rule everything.
But one could imagine that the negative vision of the crowd, some of it perhaps is actually based on something real, that is, that those in power do fear the kind of collective coming together from below and see it in negative terms, because ultimately it could be negative for those in power.
Mm-hmm. But it's something I think that I have to confess to, that coming from what I think is a progressive left framework that is always stressing openness to all, emphasizing equality, you know, against all the exclusions of people through sexism or racism or anything else, then I'm saying when we come together to think about futures, then we're welcoming of all those who want to share our vision. But of course, collective joy is felt through right-wing organizing as well. Through, indeed, you know, there is right-wing populism, you know, even fascism. You know, Hitler could get huge rallies, but then what they're rallying together for is precisely to exclude others. It's precisely to create and build, you know, literally now, of course, in the USA, their own walls of exclusion. But walls of exclusion are going up everywhere. And I don't think that they're in any way necessary. I think that nation states like the USA, like Britain, very wealthy nation states, in fact, could be sharing that wealth in ways that would generate much greater happiness, much greater openness, with people having some say in their working lives, in where they live, and so on. It really doesn't have to be, the world doesn't have to be how it is, where just, you know, it's actually the 1%, that tiny 1% that is earning almost all, you know, global wealth. It doesn't have to be like that. And it wasn't always like that. allow them to allow, you know, the shortening of the working day, to allow more resources for education and so on. All those things happened after the Second World War with the rise of the welfare state, more in Britain and Europe, but it did also happen in the USA, you know, this moment of confidence. But the problem was, as it was seen, that, you know, the profits for the very few did not keep rising, particularly after the oil crisis in the 70s, and so it sort, you know, gradually. You know, there's a real push of a whole new ideology that, that public spaces and even collectivity itself, these are all bad things. We don't want that, you know. We must have societies where every individual can compete and every individual can rise to the top. Well, by definition, of course, it can't be like that. And, you know, the reality is we're all interdependent. We're all dependent on each other, but we're not working out a way in which that can be taken up to mean. So we've really got to go back to basics and think of other ways of building our societies. And truly, we do have to. We do. You know, climate change and other things that are global warming, it means that we can't simply continue in the way that we have been going. Now, you know, I'm sure you've heard all this before. You know, does it have to be? Do we have to have a total catastrophe? Do we have to have more global warfare before people realize that they, once again, that there is something wrong in generating this massive inequality? And, you know, this massive inequality always comes rising misery, you know, more dystopic outlook, more people, more psychiatric breakdown. I mean, here we had Wilson and Pickett doing their global surveys that the more egalitarian a society, the less inequality there is, the happier those societies are. And other people have tried, you know, to criticize their research. You can look country by country, and you find that to be so. And the countries that are most unequal, like the USA, like Britain, continue to have rising crime, rising psychiatric illness, rising, you know, violence, and this misery that we began talking about and thinking, you know, we're soon going to be in the Hunger Games where people are going to have to compete to survive. But we don't have to all compete to survive. You know, we can think of organizing things differently. That's where I begin from.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Lynn Siegel about her book, Radical Happiness, Moments of Collective Joy, and that's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Her other books include the co-authored classic, Beyond the Fragments, Feminism and the Making of Socialism. You were just describing the intensification of a form of capitalism that took hold in the 1970s and has vastly increased inequality, often termed neoliberalism. In the 1960s, this time when people did come together in ways that you describe as producing, among other things, collective joy, there were different notions about how one could get to happiness. And some people thought that the way would be through a liberation through sex. Other people had notions that were about taking collective action, changing society. There were a multiplicity of things that took place. Some of them were based on sort of lifestyle and the counterculture. And since then, there are those who have pointed to the ways that capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, helped sort of commodify those liberatory impulses of that time and redirect them into the private sphere. So happiness became something that was an individual affair. What do you make of that argument?
I think it's completely right. I mean, it's right that that's what happened, and I think the argument is a very dangerous one, because if we are only worried about ourselves and our own success, or even just our family's success, then very many of us are going to feel failures, particularly today with unemployment rising, and it's going to keep rising because there's going to be more automation. I mean, back in the 1920s, we were told people need only work 15 hours a week, or was it 25? Anyway, Keynes, the British economist, said that there was no need to be working these long hours. We could be doing other things, particularly the real needs at the moment are for care, with a rising elderly population. What we've created is a total crisis around care, because we've got dual breadwinners, with people that don't earn enough for anyone not to be in the workforce. We've got people working longer and longer hours in the workforce. At the very same time, as there have been cutbacks in nursery provision, cutbacks in youth provision, all the things that, you know, once upon a time in Britain, the welfare state promised care for people from cradle to grave. That's what Beveridge said. You know, there would be a cushion from cradle to grave. Well, now we've got exactly the opposite. You know, we've got cutbacks in all areas from cradle to grave, and that's what begins in the States, particularly under Reagan and after, from the 1980s, these cutbacks that can, you know, with the idea that everyone must be in the workforce. You know, nobody should ever be allowed to be dependent on the state for resources, even though they might be doing absolutely essential caring work in looking after the next generation, in looking after the sick and the elderly. But there was to be no support for doing that, no support for doing that, at the very same time as actually jobs were getting more precarious and hours in jobs longer, you know, the whole gig economy being created. And so there's a total misfit between how you could actually even conceive of a healthy society, one where we're able to care for each other, and the sort of society that we've created, where we're encouraging everybody to try and become that top celebrity, you know, to try and live in their houses of gold, their Trump Towers of gold, and so on. It's absurd to the point of obscene to me. When all around us we can see what the needs are, and it seems to me we could begin to see solutions if, you know, if we had higher taxes, if we encourage more autonomous production at local level. You know, the main jobs that for men are in security, they're all sort of trying to protect this inequality that's been created, rather than what do you really need? What jobs do you really need? For one lot of jobs, it's almost the case that the more important the job, the less that job will be paid. But because we've got everyone, for instance, working these long hours in the workforce, often in jobs that are seeming to create very little, what the anthropologist David Graeber calls bush jobs, where even the people doing it don't get any sense of meaning from them, because they're often these sort of bureaucratic jobs that ensuring that everybody is in work and that nobody's getting any welfare unless they can prove themselves to be utterly destitute. And even when they are destitute, it's best if those bureaucratic workers can somehow get them back into a job, rather than thinking, might there be other ways, other uses of their time that would make society better, that would be improving life for all. So what we're doing is everybody is at work in these jobs, so therefore we're completely relying on migrant labour coming in to do the essential and necessary caring work of society, because migrant labour, being usually ethnic minority labour and often people who are coming in as illegals, because it's getting harder and harder to move around the world legally, can be treated, you know, so poorly that no adequate caring can really be going on. So what I'm working on now is the crisis of care and the fact that there's a complete mismatch, as Nancy Fraser, for instance, writes about, between a financialized capitalism that's all the time with markets trying to work out how to invest to increase profits, which will usually be in property or some other type of non-productive work. It's a complete mismatch between that financialized capitalism and care and the ability to care and what she calls social reproduction. That is simply having babies, caring for each other, making life good, so that, you know, instead of going into mental hospitals or having mental breakdowns, people can feel happier and look after each other better and look after their communities and so on. So, again, you know, these are arguments. If we set aside climate change, if we set aside all the ways in which we've been taking resources out from the earth and not putting them back, if we put that aside, we can still see that we're living in communities that are just not working for most people, because they're not allowing people to be able to do the sorts of things that they want to be doing. You know, mothers have to be out, mothers of young children have to be out in the workforce, because this particular emphasis, for instance, on mothers being in the workforce rather than being on benefits to be raising their very young children. So there's also been cutbacks in schooling and so on. So I talk about this moment of one of the most exploitative moments of what some people call total capitalism, where there is nothing outside the market. And if there's nothing outside the market, you're living in a very, very unhealthy world.
Well, one of the interesting things is you've just been describing the importance of care work, which is devalued under capitalism. When happiness is considered in our time, it focuses not on that, the love that we have for our friends, our families, and the care that we would like to give them, but on a particular kind of love, romantic love, and that is central to the reigning notion of happiness. How do you think we should think about romantic love?
Well, it's interesting. One has to begin thinking about love generally. Again, it was Hannah Arendt who talked about love of the world and the importance of love of the world. And our notions of joy were often tied to notions of love originally, connected to closeness to God and so on. So it was religion that for a long time had ticket to joy, the ticket to happiness. But as that has changed, and with the rise of democracy and the emphasis on individualism, you get a shift towards romantic love being the only way to find happiness. The only way to find happiness is to find that one and only person who was made just for you, and to live happily ever after with them. And this is a modern notion that comes in with the 19th century and continues today. At the very same time, as all historical and social science research shows, that this is a very risky and dangerous thing, because if you actually look at the shrinking of households down to that nuclear couple, you find all sorts of problems of domestic violence in particular, problems of loneliness. You might have the couple, but that doesn't mean to say that this couple isn't going to be lonely. And it seems to me that putting everything, imagining that some one person is going to be able to create the whole of life for you, is going to be able to give you everything you wanted so you could block the rest of the world out, is a very troubling notion, a very risky notion, because as we know, almost one in two marriages end in divorce. And there are lots of tensions inside relationships, which actually can be eased if they, we have a sense of something, you know, wider than ourselves and wider than someone other as well. It's, you know, again, if we feel ourselves grounded or embedded in things that we also value, we also love. You know, just as we know loneliness is a huge issue. We know that a huge number of people live on their own and are made often to feel complete failures because they live on their own, rather than thinking, how do we love the world? How do we take pleasure together with others in the world itself? It can't be simply romantic love. So, you know, people love their pets, but we can love a lot more than that. You know, we can you know, love all the things that we belong to, and but that, you know, then the sources of tension have to, or many of the sources of tension have to be removed. And so I have two chapters really on the perils of desire, arguing that, you know, we can't possibly really accept the ideology that true romance is all that we need, and once we've found our Prince Charming or Princess, or even in same-sex relationships or whatever, we can sail off into a blissful future. That opens up another chapter in which there will always be struggles and tensions, and those are the things we need to share with others in the world. And, you know, we can have many different types of love, and we need to have many different types of attachments and commitments if we're not to make too many demands on someone other, if we're not to become too dependent and too possessive about someone, other people. The way to do that is to, you know, have a lot more going on in your life than simply that couple relationship, which we're going to be celebrating on the 14th of February. So that is the only thing that matters in life.
Lynn Siegel, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. Great fun.
I've been speaking with Lynn Siegel about her book, Radical Happiness, Moments of Collective Joy, published by Verso. You can find a link to that book on againstthegrain.org. She's professor of psychology and gender studies at Birkbeck College in London. Among her many books, she's the author, with Sheila Robotham and Hilary Wainwright, of the classic work, Beyond the Fragments, Feminism and the Making of Socialism. And we now end the hour by turning to an excerpt of an interview that I did with Sheila Robotham, historian and writer, about an earlier period in the 20th century when feminists and other radicals linked arms to create communal joy through various efforts to reshape how people lived collectively, the nature of work itself, and to challenge gender roles or even the notion of gender itself. I asked her to give us a sense of the range of activities that women were involved in during the turn of the last century.
They range really from people who were concerned to reclaim prostitute and were inspired by religious and ethical ideas, through to women who are involved in the feminist movement and are busy creating alternatives like little vegetarian cafes or places that women could actually go to be alone and independent, because simply to sit in a cafe on your own made people raise their eyebrows, and they thought, here is, you know, a woman of doubtful virtue. So to actually have a space that women could have was important. There are people coming from the factories and getting involved in the early attempts to organise women into unions in both countries. There's an attempt to reduce the hours of labour to 8 hours a day, and women are taking those ideas on for themselves and suggesting that men need to take account of the fact that women are also working in the home. So actually, ideas that in the early days of the women's liberation movement we thought we'd completely discovered, they were on to already.
Sure. And there were influences, since there was such a wide range of ideas and movements, focusing for now on perhaps one of the more radical parts of the spectrum. I wonder if you could talk about the sorts of influences to people who were willing to push the boundaries much further from pre-existing 19th century utopian communities and ideas such as those of Edward Bellamy, who wrote the utopian novel Looking Backwards, or William Morris's News from Nowhere. What were the influences of ideas that posited a whole different way of existence?
One of the I think we should say that actually in the background there is the fact that there's the suffrage movement, the big movement that is really affecting, you know, lots of women in this period is suffrage in both America and Britain. But there are also women, as you say, who had ideas that of a much more dramatic transformation than simply talking about women having the vote. And the origins go back in America to those women who were around the free love circles, who were small groups campaigning over issues to do really with the complete autonomy and independence of the person. So it was a very individualist vision. They believed that every individual should have rights over their person. And from that, they went on to argue for the right to say no in marriage. They challenged the idea that the husband always had a right over the woman's body in marriage, and argued that rape could occur in marriage. And these ideas were very startling to late 19th century male-dominated vision of how women should be. And from those ideas, the anarchist and free love women went on to talk about different kinds of sexuality, different ways of experiencing pleasure, and disagreed with each other quite heartily. Some argued that sexuality was essentially male and that women were more spiritual, and others said, rubbish, this is not true, women have their own sexual desires and should be able to express them freely.
And that was an excerpt of an interview I did with Sheila Robotham about her book Dreamers of a New Day, Women Who Invented the 20th Century. Robotham is a historian of feminism and radical social movements. And that's it for today's program. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.